I'll bring to order the Committee on Veterans Affairs on the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs on November 18th. First up today, I would like to welcome all of you for coming here, and I thank you. And I do like to start on time because it's disrespectful to you when we don't. So this is an informational hearing, and today we're going to talk about something that I've been talking about for quite some time with our Veterans Department, and that's the revision of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs loan program, because I would like to see, one, is that we mirror, not only mirror the federal standards, but we would also exceed those standards and work on something of a refinancing for our veterans at 100%. So, anyway, first up, we'll have Tom Mann and Steve Schlag. Is that it, Steve? Is that correct? Who's Steve? Steve?
He's right back here.
Oh, wait a minute. Are you on the agenda? I don't see you, Jim. Sorry, they didn't put you on the agenda. You're out, buddy.
Mr. Co-Chair, I was just here to do an introduction.
I see. They left you off the program. I'm sorry,
so we
Jim.
We could introduce everybody. But co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And just a quick overview in terms of response to the request of the committee. The co-chair Esquivel is exactly right. We are going to have Tom Mann, the administrator of our Veterans Services Division, lead the brief on our Oregon Veterans Home Loan Program, along with our home loan manager, who is Steve Schlag. And we also have here our underwriter, John Coffey, who I hold as much responsible as anything for the very, very low foreclosure rate that our loan program enjoys, under 3% of our total portfolio. But the other thing I wanted to say is that, again, in response to the committee, we're also going to talk about some licensing issues with regard to troops coming back and using their military skills to obtain work in the civilian job market. So I think the folks have done a really good job of preparing for today, and I hope we hit the mark in exactly what you are looking for in those two key areas that we're going to participate in today. So unless there's any questions, I'm going to get out of the way and let these people do their work.
Thanks, Director Willis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. May I make a comment as I leave?
Sure.
I notice there are five members of the committee, and four have titles. And then there's Representative Huffman. I'm embarrassed for you, sir. I'm going to get you something to call you.
Well, let's
Jim,
just,
thank you for feeling
we'll just
my
give
pain.
Him
I do feel your
pain. Let's
confuse
him.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Okay. Problem solved.
Just call him sir around here.
Yeah. Problem solved.
Thank you, Director Willis.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Mann. I am the administrator of the Veterans Services Division at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And just to kind of introduce folks, Steve Schlag is our loan manager of the OrVet Home Loan Program. And I will second what the director said about John Coffey. He is the best underwriter in the business. And we are just very blessed as an agency to have a guy who understands this business so well and keeps us out of trouble. What I'd like to do is go through a little bit of a PowerPoint for you. In your package, you should have the PowerPoint. You should also have a couple of federal bills, HRs, that we'll be talking about, dealing with the money we use and this refi issue. Feel free, as always, to ask any questions during the middle of it if they come up. What I will do is I will answer to the best of my ability, but I'm going to defer to these two experts on anything technical, which I'm sure we'll get to. With that, let me start off by telling you the home loan program was established in the Constitution, which is kind of a unique kind of thing. Usually we do things statutorily, but after World War II, they felt very strongly as the troops were coming home, they were going to get their GI Bill, but what could Oregon do for these World War II veterans? And they decided that a home loan program was in order. So they stuck in the Constitution, Article 11A, the home loan program. As we've gone through since World War II, 66 years, we've had 334,000 loans made at $7.7 billion. It's been very successful. In fact, at one point in the state of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs was the largest loan agency in the state. And at one point, we used to have, what, about 124,000 loans on the books? We were a fairly significant organization. You may recall that our agency used to have 600 people. We used to have 14 field offices where we would do loan work. And so that was kind of the backbone of the agency for a lot of years, was this home loan program. The funding mechanism is pretty much the crux of what this discussion is going to be about. Currently, there are two types of funds. There's something called pre-Ullman money. And pre-Ullman money is there are some restrictions, but fairly loose in terms of what you can do with it. However, in the early 1980s, Congress passed a law that pretty much eliminated our ability to use these tax-free pre-Ullman non-restricted funds. And they created something called a qualified veteran mortgage bond, with a lot of restrictions. At the time, it was you had to be able to use that bond money within 30 years of discharge. You could not refinance with it, and it was not fungible. You couldn't do anything else with it. It was restricted. In recent years, they changed it to a 25-year restriction, meaning that you can use qualified veteran mortgage bonds only 25 years after discharge. But we can get about $100 million of that a year should our program be that successful. We do have pre-Ullman money left. We have about $50 million of that unrestricted money. You may recall you guys helped us with Ballot Measure 70, where we passed a law changing the Constitution, allowing veterans past that 30-year, which was also in the Constitution, to have loans. We used the pre-Ullman money for those post 25, 30-year folks that come to our agency. Before, we weren't able to do that because constitutional restrictions. So the pre-Ullman money is there for that. It's also, because it's unrestricted, we have some flexibility with that money. The QVMBs are the problem. And as we go through this brief, you'll see that we've been working for a long time to try to get the QVMB rules, which are federal rules, changed so they will relax the restrictions on not being able to refinance and relax the restrictions on it being a limited 25-year program. And we'll show you those bills. When you look at the eligibility for our current program, you recall that you helped us change the definition of veteran two sessions ago, and under 408-225, ORS 408-225, we broadened what a veteran was, and we actually took seven definitions and statutes and made them one. Well, the eligibility for this program now is ORS 408-225. If you're a veteran in the state, you qualify. And that was a big deal, because under the Constitution, in the original one, they said you had to serve 210 days of active duty and a couple other pieces. Well, when our National Guard folks started deploying after 9/11, the military, the Defense Department, was deploying them for 178 days. They didn't qualify for the loan, even though they had gone to combat. And so we wanted to make sure made sure this loan program tracked very clearly with all the other veteran benefits, that this benefit could be under the same eligibility requirements. So that was very helpful. That was part of Ballot Measure 70, and we thank you very much for helping us with that. The underwriting guidelines, this is where this agency, and this is before I came to this agency, has done just a yeoman's job. While the rest of the industry were doing subprime loans and getting themselves in huge amounts of trouble, John Coffey held the line about what would be a good risk for the agency. Now, under statute, we can do up to 100% loans, but pretty much our product's a conventional loan. It's an 80-20. And if you don't have 20% down, then you must have mortgage insurance, because we don't want to have this risk of not being able to have someone get them into a bad loan. You know, one thing we think about is we don't want to put a veteran in a loan that they can't afford. Now, in the subprime process that happened that kind of wrecked the entire industry, there were people being put in loans that they just couldn't afford. And we just didn't do that. And we stuck to our underwriting guidelines, and that's why you don't see us having all these foreclosures that everyone else is having, and we'll get to that in a moment. Currently, however, the rest of the industry is tightened up because of what's happened in the loan market, and you can see that we need a minimum credit score of 660. I can tell you, back in the old days, when we had those 334,000 loans, almost 100,000 were to World War II veterans, and the underwriting guidelines were a lot more loose. Pretty much, if you walked in, you could get the loan. We had about 77,000 of those loans go to the Korea War veterans. And so a big chunk of our 334,000 loans that we've done over the history of the program were those early loans to World War II and Korea War veterans coming home, which was why the program was established. You can see that we've talked about the minimum down or for your row houses and condominiums. We've talked about the mortgage insurance. We feel very good about our underwriting. We're just not in the kind of trouble others are. When you start looking at our delinquency rates, where most people are in the double digits and moving up high double digits, we're in single digits, low single digits, and we'll get to that in a moment. Our current portfolio is 2,686. I found an interesting fact as I was studying this. So when we had 140,000 loans on the books, the value of our portfolio is the same as it is today, because all those loans were smaller, much smaller. Currently, we can loan up to $417,000 on our loans. Back then, we were probably doing $10,000, $5,000. So our portfolio size, in terms of a value, has stayed about the same, even though we've significantly reduced in the number of loans we have on the books. Our current loan portfolio balance is $238.6 million, and our delinquency rate, and this is interesting, is 2.64, but that's 17 days or greater. You know, usually when you talk about delinquency, you're talking 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. This is a number that we track internally, and 2.64 for 17 days. Usually people are getting squared away within 30 days, 60 days. When you look at our 90-day delinquency rate, about a 1.5, 1.54, somewhere around there. That's pretty darn good. Be honest with you. When you look at other organizations like Federal VA, you'll see that number be about 11. And so we feel pretty good about the delinquency rate. And then our foreclosure accounts, you'll see we have 13 in foreclosure. This group here, plus a number of us at the agency, sit on a foreclosure review board. And every foreclosure or possible foreclosure comes to us with, and we sit down and we hash it out. We just had one where we spent days trying to find a way to help this person. What we're finding, though, is people are walking away from their loans. It's the most, I find it very strange personally, but they either just get to the point where they just can't do it anymore, and no matter what we offer them, they say, no, we're just going to walk away from it. And but 13 out of a portfolio of 2,686 is pretty darn good. Some of you may remember during the 80s, this program had hundreds and hundreds of foreclosures when we had that huge fiscal crisis in the 80s, and we had 500 state-owned properties. We don't have that anymore. What we have is usually low teens like that. We're able to turn around our state-owned properties pretty well, and we feel pretty good about where we're at right now. But we continue to work with our lenders any way we can, or our borrowers any way we can, to just try to keep them out of this foreclosure piece. And we've talked before about the flexibility we have in the program to do that. I was interested in this, and I asked Steve to help us with this information. I wanted to know how many calls we get a month in the loan department and what they're asking for. So on an average month, 327 calls, 300 are asking for refi. We recently lowered our interest rate to 3.65, and the phones went crazy, and everyone wanted to refi. And we had to tell everyone we can't do that. Now, I want to qualify that. I made the comment earlier that we have this $50 million of pre-Allman money. It's non-restricted. We can refi with that. If we opened up refi with pre-Allman money, we did some math and we figured it would be gone within a month to a month and a half. And the phones would still ring because there's so many people interested in refinancing. So a group of veterans within about anywhere between 30 to 60 days would get refinanced. And then all the other veterans would call you guys because they were mad at us because we wouldn't refinance them because the money would be gone. And we would have no money to do the ballot measure 70 veterans, and we would have no money to have any kind of flexibility with those non-restricted funds. But we have been talking about maybe taking 10, 20 million of it and offering refi to help the portfolio. But it's difficult because what we've talked about, and I've talked to a community administrator about, is do you want a sustainable program for refinancing, or do you want a very short-term open-close where some people get to refinance, but not everyone gets to refinance? And it's been kind of a tough policy call for us. We've debated it quite a bit. We've, at this point, gone with the idea that we'd rather have something that's sustainable, just because if you help one group of veterans, it's not fair to the other group that you don't help. But we're still discussing that. The way we work, because we no longer have 14 field offices or 600 employees, we have 86 employees, we have broker lender that help us originate loans. They're partners with us, and there are 77 brokerages that participate in the Orvet Home Loan Program. We also have 13 lenders that will sell the Orvet Home Loan, which is fantastic. And that number you see, 431, is how many per year that they, on average, that they send to us applications. And an application would be the application and all the accompanying documentation. So we are very reliant upon our partners in this process, and we need to get more, to be honest with you. I'll tell you that one of the scary numbers for us was there used to be about 4,500 mortgage brokerage firms in the state. What are there now, about 1,000?
There were 14,000.
14,000, man, my license. Numbers are rough.
License.
14,000 licensed, and they've all closed up because business is so bad. And so that's... That tells you a little bit about the struggle we have in terms of using these partners. We used to have a lot of partners, and that number has shrunk, which means we don't have as much reach as we used to have. Go ahead there, Nick. Federal legislation. Okay. We went to Senator Wyden, and actually we went to the entire delegation, and we said, look, the qualified veteran mortgage bond, great, tax-free bond, we want to use it, but we need to get those restrictions off. We need two things. We need to eliminate the 25-year rule and make it a lifetime benefit like the federal VA loan and now like the Orvet home loan. And we need to be able to refi with it. We need to be able to take that language out of the statute that says you can't refi with these things. We have submitted legislation for years. And I'll be candid with you that we've been told by the delegation that even if we get it through the House, we're going to have problems in the Senate because the chair of the Senate Finance Committee doesn't like the state home loan programs. As you may recall, there are five of us, Oregon, California, Texas, Alaska, and Wisconsin. And the finance chair seems to think that's a parochial issue, it's a state issue, it's not their problem. And so we've been trying to get some push behind these bills, but honestly, as an agency, we're just not big enough, loud enough, have enough juice to get those bills moving. We can get them introduced, the delegation signs on, and the California delegation signs on. Last year, we thought we had a real chance when Speaker Pelosi was there because California has the program. But Governor Schwarzenegger gave his priority list to Speaker Pelosi about what California wanted, and they did not put these bills on the list. And so they did not go forward with it. So we have just been trying every way we can to try to get some traction on these two bills, and we need help, honestly. We just don't have the guns to pull it off ourselves, even with our congressional delegation being 100% behind these two ideas. Near-term outlook. You know the economy is not doing great. My director was recently at a Rotary Club meeting where a realtor was presenting, and this realtor said, it looks like it's going to be flatlined for the next 10 years. I think that's what our state economists are saying. That's how we feel at the agency, that you're not going to see this huge spurt of home buying. What you're going to see is this being a refinance market. Everyone using these low interest rates to try to refinance to lower their interest rates. A lot of people we have call pretty much finance their homes like 5%, 5.5%, maybe 6%. And so when they see 3.6%, they get very excited. And I would too. So being able to do that refinance piece would be great. But we're just having to turn so many people away. The number was interesting that Steve Schlag shared with me. As of September of this year, 75% of all applications across the country were for refinance. So it kind of gives you an idea. It's not just Oregon. Everyone's looking to refinance everywhere. Unlike World War II and Korea and even Vietnam, we're not seeing large groups of troops coming home. You know, after World War II, everyone went for 4 years, and then they all came home. War was over. VE Day, VJ Day, everyone came home. And it has great benefit, and everyone used it. We're not seeing hundreds of thousands of veterans come home like that. What they do is they come home like the 41st Brigade and 2300 here. They come home from active duty, onesies and twosies. The reserves do the same thing. It's much more difficult to get a hold of them. And without having those 14 field offices like we used to, we're not in their communities anymore. And so it's not kind of an omnipresent advertising and marketing system like we used to have. So there are some issues there in terms of how do you get a hold of veterans. And this generation of veterans, I saw through this realtor, she had done a study, or read a study, that said this generation, whatever they call them, X, Y, Z, whatever they are, they aren't like previous generations that want to settle down, have a home, have a job for the rest of their lives. They believe that they're going to have multiple jobs, they're going to keep a job 2-3 years and move on. They're very transitory. They don't want to settle down and get married and have kids until their mid-30s nowadays, where previous generations were much earlier. So they view their world a lot differently. So when we're talking about our veterans that are 19, 20, 21 coming home, it's a different demographic than we've ever dealt with. So that's something also to keep in mind as we think about our marketing and how we're going to talk to this generation, because that's the generation that is going to be the future of this program. There was also something called the Dodd-Frank Act. They changed some rules in Congress regarding the whole industry in a response to the subprime dilemma. I'm not articulate on that, so I'm going to let my experts talk about that if you have questions about Dodd-Frank, but it did affect how we do our business. So the question that probably is on your mind is on my mind is, what are we going to do? Honestly, what do we do? As you know, our agency gets about $6 million in general fund. Half of it go to the counties for the county veteran service officers. The other half comes to our programs for our veteran services. But it certainly doesn't pay for what we do at the agency. Our spread and our reserves from our loan program pay for our agency, for the bulk of it. And it's not sustainable. As we're not selling as many loans, as we have less loans on the books, as we're losing portfolio because people are refinancing outside of the agency, what are we going to do? The director has told us to take a look at doing federal VA loans, using those QVMBs, using the loan guarantee from the federal VA. There are some real positives to it. It's a guaranteed loan, so if it goes under, there's guarantees there. We would have to have a statutory change to do it, however. In statute currently, we can do up to 100%. We would need to do, right now, 103% and maybe more. And what that's for is VA charges a funding fee when you do a loan for them. Steve can be more articulate about this than I am, but it's kind of their mortgage insurance piece. They take that funding fee and bank it as part of the security. So what we would want to do is pass an amendment to that current statute so we could do 105 loan-to-value ratio. That way, if VA changes its rules, we still have a little bit of room, and we could be able to do that loan. I will tell you that I'm having Steve and John take a look internally what we would have to do restructuring-wise to be able to do the federal VA loan. They have some different rules than we have in terms of servicing and borrowers and the eligibility pieces, and we're working on that right now. If we were to go forward with doing a federal VA loan, once that statute's changed, we're thinking about 4 to 6 months to do the internal reorganization we have to do to get ready. There's some software changes, some things. And then whenever we can get that statute changed, that would be the trigger for us to have everything in place. On refinancing, the reality is we either need to change the federal law or we need a non-restricted line of credit somewhere. And there are some unique ideas out there. You could do lottery. You could do PERS, you could do task treasuries they have, someone who's going to make an investment. But this is a really important point. This is not asking for revenue. We're not asking for people to give us money so we can go use it. What we need is a line of credit so we can sell loans and they get their money back based upon the interest, and it's an investment. Some investments make more than what our interest rates are. We get that. One of the questions was, well, if we went to PERS and asked them to do this for us, you know, their investments make more than 3.65%. We said, yeah, but some of them don't. Some of them making 2%. You have a portfolio when you do this, and this would be just part of the portfolio, an investment where they earn back this money. But as you can tell, when you look at that second idea, that's pretty out of the box. But that's how we would get to a way of doing unrestricted third leg of the stool money to be able to do this. The only other way that we can see is to have that federal law change so we can do the refinancing. And again, we would need your help in significant ways to get that moving, because right now the bills haven't even gotten a hearing or scheduled or anything like that for committee. So I'm sure that you folks have a lot of questions about the program. That's kind of the 45,000-foot overview. Take any questions you have, and like I said, I'll probably defer to my two experts here as we go forward.
Any questions of Mr. Mann? I have a couple. One is that when people walk away, usually in a market like this, it's due to the fact that the value of the house, the home, isn't even close to the value of the mortgage itself. So therefore, I believe they call that an intellectual foreclosure, where they just decide, I'm out of here. And example, you'll have a house that's maybe worth $100,000 and you may own $200,000 on it. So they just turn around and walk away from it. You had a few foreclosures that you were contemplating. I believe you had three or four, whatever it was, the number. What means do you do to rectify that situation and work with the veteran to alleviate that, or is that where you're finding that they're just walking away from it?
Mr. Chair, I would tell you that first thing that happens is we have somebody that is responsibility is to call the veteran and talk to them and work with them, and we go through a long process trying to determine what their finances are like. You're right. What happens, they end up underwater. They end up having a home that is worth less than they owe, significantly less, and they get to the point where they either walk away because the investment's bad, or we've also had situations where people have lost their jobs and they've taken a job where they're not making as much money and they can't afford the payment or those type of things. So what we do first is we try to work with them and say, what's your situation? Where are you at? How do we help you? I mean, what can we do? We have this thing called a TRP, which is a temporary reduction of price or of the loan cost, so we can reduce their loan payment temporarily for a period of time. That's one of the options we have. We've talked before about if they miss a couple payments, we can put those on the back end of the loan and work with them that way. But what's been hard with these veterans is what you're saying, is they have an intellectual foreclosure. They decide, nope, this just isn't going to work out for me. And as we try to work with them, we're finding that no, it's not. And what complicates things, and I'm getting a little out of school, but I'm just going to kind of lean over here. Sometimes there's a second on the house, and the second will foreclose.
Second's the problem.
The second will foreclose. Yeah. And so that creates a problem as well. We just had a really unique case where a older gentleman continued to refinance and refinance and refinance. It wasn't refinance. He was taking money out, kind of doing equity loans back when we did that. And he's been paying us money for decades. And he should have been out of his loan years ago, but he kept on pulling money out to do like home improvement projects and those type of things in our home improvement loan. And the family, now that the gentleman is in a nursing home, says, hey, we don't want to do this anymore. And we're like, we're kind of stuck because you owe the money, you've been borrowing the money, you signed the notes. So we find a lot of times when we're taking back these properties under foreclosure, we're going to lose money. I mean, there's the bottom line. What is the average? About $50,000 a house that we're losing when that happens.
Yes.
Oh, Representative Parrish. I have a laundry list of questions.
Okay.
Well, you know, we're kind of close to this, right? Because we hear this from soldiers a lot.
Absolutely.
And so I wanted to get some questions answered. You know, when you're talking about somebody who's losing their house like that, is this program set up at all to be transferable to another soldier? Mm. So the older gentleman who's now in a nursing home, can we advertise that house out to another soldier and transfer them into that loan? I mean,
Mr. Chair, a federal loan is assumable by, I believe, anyone, not necessarily a veteran.
Right.
That's to help out the veteran to get out of that situation. Do we have that flexibility?
I'm going to defer on the assumable part. I know that in terms of if a home ends up as a state-owned property, there are some rules about that. But I'm going to let Steve talk about that assumable part, because the federal loan is a little bit different than our loan on that.
For the record, my name is Steve Schlag. I'm the loan program manager for the Department of Veteran Affairs, Chair Esquivel, Representative Parrish. Fundamentally, on the new loan program, the assumability portion is really not available. The deeds of trust represent upon sale or transfer that's to be paid off, so the assumability is actually available. The old loan program was much more so the case. the issues surrounding the old load program where you can adjust a rate in those respects. The new loan program, you cannot. What the original rate is the note rate.
So is that a state issue that it's not? Sorry. Is it a state issue that that's not assumable or a
that
federal?
That would be correct.
So we could potentially change that.
So it's a state issue.
Again, there would have to be a change in the documentation, the usage of the deeds of trust. Most deeds of trust now that we see, having been a banker of over 28 years and having been around the pike a couple of times, the deeds of trust that are used predominantly with the lenders in the marketplace are all the same. Fundamentally, they're all the same. These deeds of trust are the same deeds of trust that are used in the marketplace.
I still got a laundry list. So Soldier comes in and gets a new loan through you all. You lend up to $417,000 and then sells the house successfully, wants to go back and get another loan. Is it still, because we actually used this once upon a time, had the $417,000. I'll just declare my conflict of interest right now. So we tapped about $200,000 when we first moved back to Portland. Is it still the case then that how much more we could go back if we were to go buy another house through this program is only the difference of what we didn't use, or is it have you changed it? Because at one point that was the case, versus changed it back to I could go back out and if I qualify all the way around use the 417 again.
Coach Esquivel, Representative Parrish, I did review your loan, by the way, and it was performed extremely well. But yes, that is true, that there's a two-loan maximum, some limitations insofar as what we can do to restore lending rights. And yes, the current maximum loan amount is $417,000, which is the conforming lending limit set by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so, yes, in your particular case, easy math, 417, subtract 200, come back for a second loan, you're eligible for $217,000.
But sadly, we don't have $217,000 houses through, you know, a lot of Portland and through the suburbs and places where some of these folks are buying, even with the housing prices depressed, you know. So is that a state?
Yes, that's rule. Exactly right. Okay. That would have to be an amendment and a change as well. If we were going to mirror FedVA as an example, you know, that's a lifetime benefit as ours is now. However, that is a multiple use, infinite use. Ours is fundamentally two and you're done, or up to whatever the maximum may be. So,
one of the other challenges I hear from soldiers is when they are out looking for loans is the ability to have their military pay recognized for what it is. So there's a big chunk of it that's tax-free. That has some additional value when you're looking at trying to add up the numbers of what somebody's pay is. There's the stability of the pay, right? They're in the military, we get a paycheck every month. If they're retired, we're getting a retirement every month. And your Quicken loan type people, I don't want to single anybody out, or somebody who's along those lines, you know, mortgage.com or any of these places people are looking for a loan, they don't understand the stability of the pay. And I think I hear from folks who've, you know, tugged me on this issue already, you know, knowing that I get a chance to ask these questions. When you are processing these loans, do you factor that in? Because obviously you have a fundamental understanding of the pay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, let me introduce you to John Coffey. Yes, the answer is yes. We also take in VA disability pay, pension pays, all those type of things. But John, why don't you share how you do your job?
Hi, I'm John Coffey. I'm the underwriter. I'd like to preface my response, if I may, with two comments. One, I just had oral surgery the other day. I apologize for the giant gap in my mouth. They gave me an artificial device to put in there, and if I wear it, I can't speak. Number two, while I enjoy basking in the praise of Director Willis and Mr. Mann regarding the results of my underwriting, you're going to watch me commit career suicide. It's not me. We lend to an honorable and disciplined demographic in the state of Oregon. The success of our portfolio is due to our borrowers. Now, Representative Parrish, to your question, a military pay stub has about 60 different entries on it, and most folks in the private sector look at that, their eyes glaze over, and they have no idea what they're looking at. There are arcane little entries like BAS and BAH, things like that.
BSP.
There's a dollar amount. What does it mean? Well, for instance, BAH is basic allowance for housing. That is a tax-free portion of the compensation, but if you don't know what it is, you don't know how to treat it. So we are able to make loans in situations where other lenders won't, simply because we understand what we're looking at. Tom referenced disability compensation. Disability compensation is tax-free. Some Social Security compensation is tax-free. When we take in an application from someone who is a W-2 employee, we look at their gross income, even though we know there are taxes deducted from that sum of money. When we look at somebody who is receiving disability compensation, we make a 25% upward adjustment in that dollar amount to compensate for the actual spendable dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Well, it does, because, I mean, I know how that works, but we've had to explain that to private sector mortgage people a lot. So it's good to hear that you guys immediately just qualify that and understand that, and because I think that's a challenge I hear when folks have come to, you know, my husband and said, we're struggling to get a loan and I need you to write something that explains this pay, that is a challenge and a barrier to housing for soldiers when they can't explain what that looks like. My laundry list is going still. Can I just finish it?
This is the Representative Parrish show today, brought to you by.
Sorry. The changes in the mortgage programs that the President just announced, are you guys in any way participating in that? Your loans don't go to Freddie or Fannie to qualify those programs.
Coach Chair Esquivel, Representative Parrish, no.
Okay.
Make a long story short. Since our loans are not sold to the secondary investment market, they're all portfolioed. We are the lender, we're the servicer. We are unable to participate. However, the other piece of participation that we can and are participating in at this point are we receiving some of the hardest hit fund monies that just have recently come into the state of Oregon that is being administered by Oregon Housing through their OHSI program. Oregon Housing Stabilization Initiative. We do have a few loans that have been qualified there to participate, but outside of that, no. It is really coming down to those loans that are sold on the investment market to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Under federal loan programs such as Fed VA, FHA, and USDA Guaranteed Rural, they have their own particular modifications that you must adhere to in some aspects.
One more that I've written down, so I won't promise that I don't have any more.
One last question, Representative.
You know, I know carve-outs, people don't like carve-outs. They like laws and rules and whatever for that kind of fit folks. But one of the challenges, and I've personally been through this challenge, is we PCS people around the state. And they're active, like Army National Guard soldiers, and we don't have base housing. And I currently have a soldier who's sleeping in my basement because his house in Ashland can't sell. How do we look at refinancing for people who we are actively moving around the state who could come in and refinance through you because we are asking them to go to Ontario and Ashland and Astoria and Portland metro area? And, you know, this was our challenge when we bought our first house. We went to Mark's boss and we said, you know, hey, we want to buy a house and we're getting married and on and on and on. Are we going to move anytime soon? 9 months later, we moved. Our loan interest was at 8.5%. We weren't selling that house and then the rancher thrashed it. So, you know, for this handful of folks who we are asking to bounce around and move, how do we, within this program, find a way to solve that problem for them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, it's very difficult within this program. When we talk about refinance, we're just stuck, and we just cannot do it. However, you asked a question earlier about two loans we talked about. There is a provision in the statutes that if you do get moved like that, you can get another loan beyond your two. But in terms of saying, and we're actually going through this with a veteran, right, or with a National Guardsman right now who moved, I believe, from Springfield to Salem. And we were just talking about this exact situation where it's very difficult for us because our hands are so tied with those QVMB monies, what we can and cannot do with them. The question might be, as we think about this together, if we look at the pre-almond, and well, I'll have to talk to our CFO a little bit about this, can there be some emergency type of things you can do with the unrestricted funds in that lane? And maybe we should sit down and talk a little bit about what that looks like and how many soldiers we're talking about, because I know exactly what you're talking about, and we're actually seeing it at the agency as well.
And I really would like to, you know, find a way to, you know, get for, especially because I've been living in my basement for a few months. So, but you know what I mean? Because what do? Your house is there. He can't sell it. Duty station's now up in Clackamas. You know, family sitting down there in Ashland waiting for him to, you know, find a way to solve this. We need to find a way to solve this for soldiers.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Tom, you just brought it up. I was going to ask if that were possible, that maybe you guys look at the rules and look at that restricted pot of money and say under this condition that Representative Parrish addressed, where we're asking a soldier to relocate within the state, that maybe that's the exception to the rule, because I can't imagine that, you know, that would be too much money in comparison to the size of the pot, restrict it, but that would seem like a plausible answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I would tell you that when I think about it in terms of trying to protect unrestricted funds for the things we have to do, I like the idea of doing something that has some boundaries on it, some guardrails. So let me go back to the agency, talk to the CFO, talk to the director, and see what they think about that, and we'll talk more about what that looks like.
And is that a rule? Is that a rule change, or is that something we need to change in statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, you heard Steve talk about old loans and new loans. It's actually kind of old money, which is the pre-almond money, versus the new money, which is the QVMB money. With the pre-almond money, we have the authority to do that because it is unrestricted. And so we've just been very careful about unrestricted funds, just because, again, we pay for everything in the agency with those spreads and those reserves and some of that money. We got to keep running the agency. And so, but I think that there might be some maneuver room here.
Great. That's awesome.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I commend you on your efforts with the foreclosure. This afternoon we'll be having a hearing in General Government and Consumer Protection on foreclosures and really how we have that conversation prior to a foreclosure. And so I commend you on that. And my question is, as I look at your portfolio, I mean, the average loan to portfolio is probably less than $100,000. And your delinquency rate is really, really low. And you only had, 13 accounts that went into foreclosure? How many prior to going into foreclosure, how many success stories are there of having that foreclosure, kind of an intervention, and just kind of ballpark it, where you have a team assembled? So I have this question of how many times are you successful in that process where you get them restructured? And the other question is, how much effort does it take to make it? Now, how much, you know, what are we talking about effort on your part?
Co-Chair Esquivel, Representative Matthews, I can't cite in a specific number, but I can tell you that there are a tremendous number of success stories that my account management officer, Cecil Baird, works with on a daily basis. To put maybe something in a little closer perspective, we have 13 foreclosures currently. I would hazard a guess at this point and give you a number of, there are probably about 2.5 dozen to 3 dozen loans that he is currently working on in some manner or fashion in which he is working on a workout format. Again, the fortunate portion of all of this is that we don't have that many loans that are going bad. Cecil does a tremendous job in preventing a number of problems. In those 13 foreclosures we currently have, there are two of those loans that went to foreclosure as a result of deaths. And the majority of those loans that are in foreclosure have come about a result of the borrowers simply will not pay. Not cannot, but will not. There's a tremendous difference between how you treat those who will not pay versus those who cannot, or having difficulty. So the number of loans that we're working on now is a very, very low number in comparison to Oregon numbers specifically. So
thank you.
May I jump in?
I think that we've allocated about 45 minutes for this, and I think it's about 45 minutes, not enough. because this brings open so many avenues and so many questions. I will talk to Representative Witt, Co-Chair Witt, and I would like to see us embark upon some kind of a work group to come back and discuss this in a little more detail, because it seems like the more we talk about it, the more we end up. But Representative Witt and I will discuss this privately. Yes, Co-Chair.
Just one question that I'd like to ask here before the panel is retired. If we were to make the 400 and what was it, 17,000 available for each loan rather than total, would that necessitate the additional unrestricted capital to loan out to make that feasible?
Mr. Chair, I would tell you that I'm going to defer to Steve on how we would do that 417 for each loan, but it wouldn't, because we get $100 million worth of QVMB a year if we so choose, if we're selling that many loans. So I don't think there would be a problem if we were going hot and heavy and selling lots of loans to get the extra bonding to do that.
Do you, Mr. Chairman, would you expect that that would still be true if we were in a hot real estate market?
Mr. Chair, what's really exciting for ODVA is when the real estate market is going strong, our loan rates are usually lower than everybody else, and that's where we've been very successful over the years. The limit used to be $25 million a year of the QVMB bonding, and that wasn't enough, because we were selling that much. And so that's why when they raised it to $100 million, the quid pro quo on that from Congress was, we're going to drop it down to 25 years from 30 years of eligibility, but they gave us $100 million per year. So we feel very strongly that as the market, because the market's going to get better sometime. Down the road, it's going to get better, and we're going to be selling loans, and we're going to be in that great position of being lower than everybody else and having the money to do it.
Anything else?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
If we have an exceedingly responsible group of individuals who are making good on their mortgage payments, it would appear to me that we ought to loan them the amount of money that they need. So,
yeah.
Thank you, Representative Parrish.
I agree with that. So, anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate that. Evidently, I believe that Director Wiltz wants to talk a little bit more here to us. I assume that, Jim, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to leave you with two thoughts about this program, or two facts. The last time we amended the IRS tax code, which controls how we use qualified veteran mortgage bonds, the effort was led by Representative Ryan of Wisconsin, which is one of the states that has a home loan program. We were given almost zero chance of passing that bill. However, once we brought in the people from Texas and California, along, of course, with the folks from Alaska and our state, we passed that bill. And we amended the IRS tax code, which most people say is impossible. To do this refinancing that Tom and others have mentioned to you this morning, and to change the QVMB financing to lifetime eligibility, like we did with Measure 70 here, is requiring amendment to the IRS tax code. I just want everybody to be really clear about that and understand what the numbers are. If you do the aggregate of California, Texas, Wisconsin, Oregon, and Alaska, you're talking about one-fifth of all the veterans in the United States. That's a big number, and it should be a powerful number. What I'm concerned about as director is a Congress looking at what is, as of today, a $15 trillion deficit at the federal level. Now, when you heard the Senate Finance Committee at the U.S. Senate being not friendly toward the qualified veterans mortgage bonds, it's because of two words, tax-free. So when they feel they're not getting any taxes, why should they change the rules? Two answers to that. Number one, this is not a federal risk. This is the states taking the risk. and we have from 1945 on. So this isn't the federal government. Secondly, every time we make a loan, it results in people paying tax. The people that built the homes, the people that did the loans, the people that do the repairs, and certainly the people that buy the homes. So I think it's a tax generator. And the QVMVs are nothing more than an investment by the federal government in the states. So as Tom told you, I couldn't agree more. We really need your help on these two federal bills. If we pass those, it will make all the difference in the world, and I promise you that we will do significant business in the refinancing. And it may even lead to some way out in terms of refinancing for those folks who got a loan and got themselves in trouble where their interest rate is higher. And we might be able to do a refi, get their payment down to where they can stay in their home, because we don't win when people lose their homes. We want them to stay in the home. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I had.
Any questions of the director?
Thank you, Director Willis.
You're welcome.
Couple things. One is that I would like you to email to every one of us justification on why you want to get into the federal loan program, because the federal loan program is a separate entity, and I'm not sure I really like that idea, but you can convince me. I have an open mind. I don't know how the rest of us feel, but I mean, I think that's a different bailiwick than state. The other thing is, if we could get emails from each of the members here to maybe get a work group, if Co-Chair Witt and I decide we want a work group on this particular issue, I'd like to have us email some volunteers. So just email us, let us know. Okay, moving right along, we're going to preventing foreclosures on active duty service members. We have a couple people logged in here, a Charles Williamson and a Major, is that Libel? Liebel?
Libel.
Libel?
When he gets sued, he's liable.
Yeah, that's pretty coincidental, Major. You're an attorney, aren't you? I just yes, just one, not just.
You want me to go first? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Williamson. We don't really have a lot of specific stuff about foreclosures. Bar lobbyist asked me to just brief you on what we are doing for active service members. Back in 2003, I was president of the state bar, and Chief Justice Carson and Attorney General Myers and his assistant, Peter Shepard, came to us, and Brian, I believe, came to us with an idea of getting a panel of attorneys that would help service members who were on active duty protect their legal rights so that they didn't have to worry about their families being evicted or cars being repossessed and so forth while they were in Iraq or Afghanistan. And we did set up a panel. We have now 110 lawyers on a panel. We get referrals from the military, and I believe we represent not only the service member but also their families, and sometimes we represent the families and the, I mean, we get lawyers for both the family and the service member when they're suing each other, but they need to take care of those problems. I think we do get clients through other means than simply referrals. So we've had 791 referrals just from the military. We have a committee that kind of oversees the program that's maybe a little informal now at this time since it's been set up, but we do put on continuing legal education programs on the primarily in the Civil Service Member Civil Relief Act, which provides protection for service members, again, under the theory that Congress has passed this, has had this act since the 40s, and it has been updated, but to try and help service members be protected from legal process while they're on active duty, so they don't have to be worried about that while they're trying to fight for their country. And this affects, it affects foreclosures, it affects all areas of the law, that service members can at least have some time to respond and get some help. And the when we first started this collection agency, when we first started our panel collection agencies and banks and landlords and so forth, didn't know about the service member civil relief act, and they weren't just backing off when they were told. They would just keep going ahead. But I think by now they're fairly well aware of it. So we've given CLEs to folks so they know about it. We've given CLEs when there's an update. Any member of the bar can watch the CLE online from the bar website. We have a listserv so everybody that volunteers can be, send out questions to everybody else. Hey, I got this problem. Do you know a lawyer that can do this? The program, I was surprised to see the program. It just says you get 1 hour of advice, and then you can do something else. I think everybody that gets a client like this, if they have a good case, will represent the person. At least I always have without fee to the end of the... But it gets them in the door, and sometimes it gets them a referral to some lawyer that knows more about the particular problem. The Board of Governors of the Bar is having their annual retreat this weekend, in fact today, and they are considering ways to expand free legal services to veterans and their families. And I think it is that there's a lot of need for folks who are not necessarily on active duty, but people with PTSD, that there's a huge need for folks that have come back. Jess Barton, who was unable to be here today, but who's probably been the biggest spark plug of this effort, is working to try and establish veterans courts. So there'll be a judge in each county who's familiar with the problems, the unique problems of veterans, and can and the programs that might be available to help them. So our little committee has been working on that. And Jess has also been very active in lobbying and getting laws passed. And I think you've got a list of some of the laws that of laws that have been passed. I don't know that Jess or our panel has been responsible for all of them. And Brian can talk more about those. But that's just a brief history, and I'd be glad to answer questions, and maybe better off to hear from Brian first.
Major?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, co-chair Whip, members of the committee. I'm Brian Leibel with the Office of the Staff Judge Advocate, Oregon National Guard. I've been involved with the Oregon State Bar's Military Assistance Panel since it started in early 2004, and presented a number of times at legal seminars and conferences on military-related matters, namely the Service Member Civil Relief Act, and also how criminality affects military service. I can speak to legal issues that veteran service members are and have been experiencing. I unfortunately can't speak of veterans who are no longer in service when at the time that issue arises, because I just don't have that visibility when they're no longer part of our organization. Since its inception in 2004, the Military Assistance Panel has been nothing short of extraordinary. At the time, it's the first of its kind in the nation that the Military Assistance Panel has been hugely successful in resolving unique and rather complex legal issues for service members and veterans that would otherwise might not received any assistance. As Mr. Williamson stated, nearly 800 service members in the past 7 years have benefited from this program, receiving advice and representation on a wide array of legal matters. In reviewing our records past couple days, the top five legal issues that are referred to the panel are family law, so that involves dissolution of marriage, child custody, child support. That would probably be the number one issue, unfortunately. The number two law involves consumer law. So whether it's payment of a purchasing contract or having to pay on a loan or a credit card debt, those are the types of issues that are coming up. Namely, because a service member, when it's called up to active federal service, there's a pay difference between what he's making on the civilian side and that now what he's making under the military pay chart. The third issue is landlord-tenant. landlord-tenant law. And fourth is issues dealing with the Service Member Civil Relief Act, usually dealing with the enforcement of those protections that the service member needs help on. And probably a distant fifth is employment law, so whether it's reemployment, getting back to their civilian job, or dealing with unemployment. A few service members have requested assistance with foreclosure over the past several years, but the issue doesn't appear to be a prominent one. And I suspect, in reviewing the records, is because of the really the number three issue that we're experiencing, and that's landlord-tenant law. So that is, I think it's more demographics and with the service member, and whether that they're at least the folks who are calling us for assistance or wanting to get referred to the panel, is they're not in the homes. At least those ones are giving us a call. I can remember just specifically one example. I think it was in about 2005. A spouse of a service member, and the service member was deployed, and she had called me up for help, and she was out there on the coast. And she was kind of bringing me in at the 11th hour. She was having financial issues and making payments on all the obligations. And she had decided that she was just going to let some of those obligations slide. One of them was the mortgage. She'd continue to pay the utilities and the trash and all the smaller bills and just let the big one go. The thought being that she would have the opportunity to buy it back. And so fortunately, I was able to help in her invoking the protection that the SCRA has against mortgage foreclosures and sort of back up that train. That one stands out in my mind. In particular, with the Service Member Civil Relief Act, it's Section 533 that provides foreclosure protection during active duty service, plus 9 months afterwards, which give this sort of a safety net once the service member comes back in order to, for him or her to get back on their feet if there's in a financial crisis. Specifically, a lender must obtain a court order to sell, foreclose, or seize property because of a breach of a such obligation. And I think the committee was provided with a long list, but probably not an exhaustive one, of benefits and protections that the Oregon legislature has provided service members and veterans over the years. And I just want to take this opportunity to say thank you.
Any questions? Yes. Co-Chair Wick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Major, you indicated that the foreclosure, or I guess the number of foreclosures on active duty service members is relatively small. I understand that this may not be your bailiwick, and please tell me if it's not, but do you have any sense, and this may have been a question that would have been more appropriate for the previous panel, but do you have any sense what percentage of our foreclosures are due to folks who are on active duty service? I'm just trying to get a handle on the extent that this problem presents to our active duty military personnel.
Mr. Chairman, I think that where an active duty service member is involved, at least the few that I've seen over the past several years, it's tied around a deployment, where if the service member was there here stateside, it wouldn't be an issue. I think a lot of times it's the transition between civilian income to military income, and being able to make those payments, and it creates the challenge, especially if the service member is trying to cover all the financial obligations while overseas and doesn't have somebody like a spouse to do that, or maybe the spouse is not you know, sophisticated enough to cover all those obligations, and maybe you know there's a service member who's doing it, and I see that was the challenge and the difficulty was where a deployment was involved, and whether the pay was messed up, or that they couldn't bridge the difference between the military and civilian pay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I appreciate that. Would you have any recommendations for this committee in terms of alleviating some of the burden that military families face while with respect to mortgage obligations, while one or more family members are on active duty?
Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, to answer your question, not specifically at this point. I think that the big piece, and Mr. Williamson referred to it, is education. And just letting, I know, just with my experience and the number of presentations I've given across the state, is just informing folks of the protections that service members have under the Service Member Civil Relief Act. Mm-hmm. And time and time again, after a presentation, I'm approached, it's like, wow, I didn't know. I appreciate the information you're providing, and there's, you know, whether it's a county tax assessor, you know, they just don't know. And I think it's just an education piece where they have these protections, and when that the lender starts the process, you know, whether it's judicial, you know, or non-judicial, is being informed that they're dealing with a service member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me, would this information be part of a typical presentation for reintegration when our military personnel are being mustered out?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. Okay. We always brief on the protections that service members have, both on the front end, on before deployment, and post deployment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for allowing me that line of questioning, and certainly appreciate the major's very candid responses.
Mr. Chair, could I just may I speak? I think that the SCRA provides protections for folks while they're in the service, mm-hmm. and as Major Leibel said, for 9 months afterwards. But these folks get out of the service. They come home. There's a terrible job market. They have often PTSD or other disabilities. And so that the foreclosure or the other problems could be hitting 9 months or a year afterwards. They wouldn't necessarily be coming to our panel at that point. And I mean, they're like a lot of other poor people that right then that are really being trampled.
Thank you. Yes, Representative.
I think, you didn't touch on it at all, but I think one of the other challenges is that you've got, you know, when folks come back, divorce is a huge issue for our soldiers, and that just rips your finances apart. So, you know, how many folks are going through this who are suffering some of those other challenges? And then soldiers aren't their best advocates, and you guys do a great job of putting out, you know, here's how you do the call your mortgage company and tell them to reduce your rate and while you're on, you know, deployed, or your credit cards, or all the things that, you know, change interest rates, and take the county taxes. Our taxes, you know, got assessed and changed when Mark was deployed, but you have to go advocate for yourself, and I don't know how you teach people how to do that.
That's very difficult because the sailor, the Marine, the soldier, or the airman that comes home is a complete different person than the left. And same with the family. Once they come home to that family's completely changed from when they left. So it's quite an adjustment period for people. So,
anything else?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have direct licensure for veterans. We have Tom and Mark Sansusi.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to thank your committee administrator who took it upon herself to reach out to us and say, Tom, what are you doing with that work group? And unfortunately, my response was, did that thing get approved? We had had a discussion at the end of last session about having a work group to talk about how we can help military veterans who have been trained in certain jobs in the military to come right into licensing instead of having to go back to school to relearn what they've learned in the military. I don't believe we actually blessed that work group and actually put it together. So when your administrator called me, I was very excited because we're still excited about the idea, and here's why. Last session, you may recall, we passed a couple really important bills. We passed 3207, which said that if a veteran's military education and skills were directly transferable to the minimum qualifications of a public sector job, they automatically get an interview. The key to that bill was the term transferable skills, because that was brand new in statute, and we were able to define what a transferable skill was. The next thing that you folks did for us that was fantastic was we said that we were going to try to use the American Council on Education's matrix to crosswalk military occupations for an education as to how they translated into college credits. That was really, really important, because when we start talking about taking a combat medic and saying, I want to direct license them as an EMT-1, I need to know a couple things. I need to know what their transferable skills are, and I need to know how their training and education and skills translate into college credit, so we can prove that they've checked the right boxes already, don't need to go back to school for that training, and can just do what's left and or test to be directly licensed. So what I did when your administrator contacted us, we had a nice meeting, and I followed up a little later with a list of who I thought might be good for that initial meeting. What we thought we would do is invite a bunch of the players from the different licensing boards and then the various different players from employment and the people we work with in reintegration in the military department and others, and have an initial meeting and say who else needs to be at the table. And then what we would do is take a look at what I think are some low-hanging fruit. Take a look at combat medics. Take a look at truck drivers. Take a look at mechanics. Take a look at some of the things where we think they have skills that are directly transferable into the job market. At the same time, I had a great conversation with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. One of the things you helped us do last session was create a great relationship between the two agencies where we're sharing information and clients and things. And I asked them, I said, you have an apprenticeship program, and one of the areas I can't figure out how to get through is in the Navy there are the trades. You have electricians and plumbers and welders and all sorts of that stuff. How do I work with those folks who have all this skill from 20 years in the Navy? How do I get them into the trades? And they said, we got a great program. We have this apprenticeship program. And I'll tell you what we'll do. Any military member that comes on and is in the apprenticeship program for 6 months, we'll automatically apply all their military training to that program and bump them through. I said, fantastic. This is great. So what we're finding is people are very interested in taking a look at transferable skills, taking a look at what these veterans have already done, the schooling they've already had, what boxes they've already checked, and then not making them go through that whole process again when they come back home. So that would be the intent of the work group. Then what we would do if we do this is come back in January and report to the legislature, your committee, and say, this is kind of what we negotiated out. I believe this will be a negotiation. I know that in some work that Representative Matthews did on the EMT front and with the fire districts, that is some sensitive stuff. We understand that. But we think that we can get some traction with the community colleges and the different folks that do the licensing. We really think we can get somewhere on this. And the objective is clear. Because veteran unemployment is so high, especially in our rural communities, anything we can do to make people marketable and get them in the workforce is going to be extremely beneficial in that veteran unemployment arena. So that's kind of what I'm thinking, where I'm heading. I'll take any direction you have, and if you tell me yes, I will go get it done as soon as possible.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about Department of Defense support for this issue. My name is Mark Sansusi, and I'm the Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest. And now this separating service member licensing issue has now risen to the top, number one of our top 10 key issues for military families.
Last year, the Department of Defense began supporting efforts in the states to ask states to give separating service members credit so they may not be held back from finding employment or finishing a degree. We are asking states to establish policies that ensure separating service members do not have to repeat requirements completed during their military career to obtain an occupational license. We have increasingly found that separating service members are out of sync with state licensure processes that normally address the needs of applicants who have qualified through private sector experience and testing as either in-state or an out-of-state applicant. The Department of Defense is not asking for direct licensure, although the title of this presentation is that, and that's where Tom's going. We are looking for credit that's equivalent. In cases where a regulatory agency or a state board determines partial credit, but it saves time and expense to the veteran and gets them closer, then we support that. We only are seeking credit where credit is due. The recent Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics reported the overall unemployment rate for post-9/11 veterans has increased from 10.6% in October 2010 to 12.1% in October 2011. And as I said, given this problem, it's now the number one issue we're working on in our 50 states. We know that the Department of Defense has many highly skilled and qualified schools where the trained service members in wide varieties of skills and occupations. When state regulators do not recognize and accept military training and experience, it creates an additional burden and hardship upon the veteran. Matter of fact, we as taxpayers are already paying for all this training the training that these people are getting. So, Oregon is home to thousands of veterans and is a desired location for separating retiring military members when choosing where to live after they leave the service. A 2010 Defense Manpower Data Center study reported Oregon had 1,243 military people separate or retire back to Oregon in fiscal year 2010. So at roughly 1,200 annually, we can expect that highly qualified ex-military people will continue to choose Oregon's quality of life, and many will continue to choose Oregon when transitioning into civilian careers. I'm frequently asked what other states are doing in this area. In 2010, this past May, Washington State passed two bills, one for medical occupations and one for non-medical occupations, and they went into law July 22nd of this year. Washington modifies the statutory chapters of 21 commercial occupations and 14 healthcare-related occupations. And a key section of the bill I'd like to read to you states, an applicant with military training or experience satisfies the training or experience requirements of this chapter unless the secretary determines that the military training or experience is not substantially equivalent to the standards of the state. This new law, Washington law, is what we regard as one of the three best practice states going at this point. This legislation, I should point out to you, in the fiscal world we live in, was accomplished with the Washington Department of Health and the Washington Department of Licensure both reporting zero for fiscal notes, thinking they're able to absorb these determinations within their regulatory agencies. Washington State can do this, given the demands as a big military state where over 6,000 people annually separate and retire to Washington, we'd like to ask for your support, thinking maybe Oregon could do this with your 1,200. We're asking potentially for you to consider this in the 2012 session and even maybe model the basic language from the Washington bills that are now law. That's the question of truck drivers Tom just mentioned. In 2010, Washington State recognized the Department of Licensing recognizes truck drivers, commercial truck drivers, for a license. And if you're a truck driver in Iraq and you get out and you go back to Washington State and you've been driving the big rigs, you immediately get the credit to the point where you can go right to the testing process. You don't have to go to Bates Driving Technical Driving School and spend thousands of dollars learning how to drive. You can go right to the test, and that's been successful since October of 2010 in Washington State. So I'm here. I'm thrilled to be here and glad to answer any questions.
Representative Huffman had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, maybe there's a differential between certification and the trades or whatever. When I began the conversation with Cam Preuss from CCWD a few years ago, my purpose and intent was this. So I guess, you know, my hope in Senate Bill 275 was that I had no intent personally when I began the conversation, which I think kind of started this whole conversation for Oregon 3 or 4 years ago, was, you know, we weren't separating out EMTs or truck drivers, but, you know, my purpose was, if you're a veteran and you have military training, you come back into Oregon and you go to the community college, OUS, and you translate that into credit hours, certifications, whatever that might be. Somewhere along the line, did that get separated in thought that we're separating out community college or OUS credit hours versus certification?
Mr. Ribsenhoven, I don't think so. I think that Senate Bill 275, which you'll hear about shortly, is a fantastic bill, and the community colleges have been just tremendous in working that bill and doing the ACE system and doing the crosswalk that you talked about. What we did was we took another step forward. We said, you know what? There are certain jobs in the military where your training is so significant that you really don't even need to go back to community college to get your certificate or get your education, because you should just be able to go get licensed and work. And so maybe we're being ambitious, perhaps, and I'll take some direction from the committee on that. But we thought that, yes, while we do 275, because as you saw, we did 3207, we do 275, we did a number of bills last session to set this up for the ultimate plan to be, if you have somebody who has the skills, like my friend Mark has said, they've been trained by the government to do these things, they're highly trained people. I don't know if they need to go back to school and have those transfer credits. What we need to be able to do is say, if you're qualified, you're qualified. Now, what we may find, we talked about this earlier, that truck driver may be driving automatics and then they get to Oregon and they need to drive a stick shift. Well, that's a little bit different, and they may have to do some schooling on that piece. We may have an EMT candidate who is a combat medic, and they check all the boxes but three, and they need to go back to school and do that. But all those other credits transfer according to the ACE system. So what the system we're trying to set up is, because right now I don't know if we have a system. We're trying to set up a system where when you plug a veteran in, there's multiple ways that veteran can go. Part of it will be the 275 school piece. Part of it may be they're ready to get licensed. They're qualified. They've spent 20 years doing this job. They know how to do the job. They can do the job. Let's let them do the job.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Thank you, because that was my original intent. So I'm glad that you thought it through and identified that there could have been a separation there, because, you know, in my mind, not knowing exactly how it all works, I think you've nailed what hopefully will be the completion of a full thought there in my intention. So thanks.
Representative Parrish.
You know, when we talk about this, we talk about a lot and things like that are very kind of tangible, you know, combat medics and truck drivers and things like that. But I also want to point out, you know, other states are doing a really good job around teacher licensure for military, and Oregon is not very good at this. Historically, we're not very good participants in the troops to teachers program, and you've got folks out there who are teachers in their field. I took military science when I was down at Southern Oregon from a military instructor who was trained up to be a teacher, who had all of the theory of preparing curriculum and executing curriculum to students, and granted it's college level, but we've got people in the military who have advanced degrees, who are teaching and instructing in a manner of things, and this is one area that we ignore. And there are, you know, we do have this troop to teachers program, but Oregon is not very participative. And when you're talking about, we, you know, we passed a bill that says we want to give consideration, I'm assuming that included school districts, not just cities, counties. We talked about it in terms of cities, counties, state government, but that applies to school districts as well. And how do we look at that licensure piece for people who had a huge teaching components in their career, and translate that back into Oregon's classrooms?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Parrish, we are working on that, and I can tell you that in this past year in Alaska, we passed a military spouse temporary licensure bill. So if a military spouse who happened to be a teacher moved to Alaska from Oregon, they were able to get a temporary license good for 180 days while they, to get in the classroom immediately while working on the unique things that Alaska may require. That passed in Alaska, and it included teachers. Every occupation except attorneys is covered in the new Alaska law. Also, we will have a bill. We're going to have a bill in Washington State this year to the same effect. We're talking about military spouses who are frequently teachers. If in fact you were going to do a licensure credit bill in Oregon, you could consider including the Department of Ed or school teachers in that list of in the non-medical occupations we had. We had 21 commercial occupations. Teachers were not in that one, but again, we're not finished. We haven't given up on that one yet.
Co-Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be helpful to me if, Mark, you could give us a list of some of the professions that the Washington State legislation addressed, so that what would comprise maybe 75% of the folks that would be covered, what occupations?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the list in front of me, but I recall on the medical side, everything for phlebotomists and lab technicians and dental assistants and those types of things. And on the other side were engineers and engineer assistants. And again, I have that list, which okay. I can gladly provide you, provide the committee.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, does that legislation then? I'm trying to think of the mechanics of how we send the people to the appropriate licensure board. So does that, in essence, say if they meet the following qualifications, they may apply directly to the licensure board, or how is that achieved?
It's Mr. Chair, a great question, because the Department of Defense is right now working with the United States Department of Labor and the military services to determine the best way to provide the documentation of the military education and training to the individual and also the appropriate regulatory agency in the states. That's being done now, and Washington State is now wrestling with, okay, now I have a dental assistant who just got out and wants credit towards licensure, and they are working with the Department of Defense now to look at what kind of documentation there is for that training. And in some cases, there's a question of I'll call it granularity. You know, how do you know that right. somebody's had the training down to be able to read third-dimensional drawings?
Right.
And all that stuff is being worked as we speak.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that Mr. Sanssouci keep our committee up to date as that develops.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would love to do that. And by the way, I neglected to say thank you for your committee passing HB 3162 and 3163 last year, the child custody for deployed people and the disposition of remains bills that went through your committee and passed in Oregon this past year. So I want to thank you for that.
Any other questions?
And you will go ahead and send the information that was requested
to
our administrator. Thank you.
Update on Senate Bill 275. We have Ms. Caldwell and Ms. Truesdell. I didn't slay your names, did I?
Not at all. Thank you. Jared, let's go.
Good morning, Chair Escoval and members of the committee. My name is Krista Caldwell, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and I'm here to update you on Senate Bill 275, and Joanne Truesdell, President of Clackamas Community College, will follow with some examples of the work that they're doing. As an update, The American Council on Education guidelines are the standard that we use in Oregon, and everybody's clear and agrees on that. What we've determined needs to be done is training in Oregon so that everybody applies those standards uniformly. We have that training set up in February as a statewide training. All the community college registrars and admissions officers will be invited, as well the university system and Department of Veterans Affairs and the Veterans Service Officers, so that we can know that those training has happened and everyone knows what the standards are and use them in the same way. So, Joanne, would you like to?
Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell, and just want to shout out to Representative Parrish, my district. Thanks. About 3 years ago, Clackamas Community College began leading an effort around how to transcript military occupational specialties, especially in the area of training. So I'm going to do a big thing that everybody understands and then figure out where the complexities are. So this is going to be very candid. What we know is that if any of you have gone to one college, like a Linfield, and then transferred to a different college, say like a Pacific or a Portland State or Clackamas Community College, your writing course, very discreet freshman level writing course, transcripts very neatly and tidily into the other lower division collegiate writing course that Clackamas Community College offers. Oftentimes we call it writing 121 is writing 121, even if it's called writing 212. They all have the same standards. So when we started looking at the American Council on Education components, we began as an institution thinking in that terms. How difficult could this be? Automotive 111 is automotive 111 is automotive 111, except for when automotive 111 may include about 400 components in the military training repertoire that, when added together, equals automotive 111 in our institution. So it requires faculty members sitting down with the ACE catalog, walking through and identifying all of the different kinds of training that occurs. Very high quality training, there's no dispute about that, but it does require us to make sense out of discrete trainings and create a package where that credit can be awarded. I'm going to continue with automotive. For example, in our automotive program, about 108 college credits in our standard system, in the Northwest College and University system. And in that, what we have found is going through about 800 automotive trainings under ACE, we found that we have 11 complete courses out of those 800 where we can say this particular course actually transfers to this course in automotive. A particular type of brake is a particular type of brake no matter where you are in the world. So we have that. There's another situation where in engine systems, for example, we're looking at 300 courses, all very well, except that there's one component in one of our engine systems classes that's missing, and that's emissions control. I think I just heard a laugh from back there. So emissions is not something that
only
necessarily is covered in the military. So now what we have is a 7-credit class where an individual soldier has been trained on perhaps three credits of the 7 total, and we now need to figure out how to ensure that that happens, and in the course they know where to plug in on which days to get that other training. That's a little more complicated. Then we move to a situation where we have a number of trainings, another 150 trainings, that do not necessarily equate directly, but we know that there are some skills that if we test, we can actually award credit to through a credit by examination. When you start looking at a degree program and you look at those in each of the areas, it is time intensive, not impossible. I just want to be realistic about the time involved and the progress that we're making. So we've got automotive, we're working on project management, we have some level of water quality, but smaller courses that are available. Welding, other kinds of programs that we're working through. But each one of those requires us to take a look at a catalog of ACE courses that is fairly extensive. And updated regularly, because what we do know, I like to watch the program from tactical to practical, is that military often is avant-garde, always, on some particular kinds of training that we then finally offer in the civilian world. And so sometimes that transcript is updated before we're even able to offer it. So I want to make sure that you have that information. I think the other part was a very good conversation we were having about licensure. Roughly 4 years ago, we had a summit in our district regarding the medical community, and especially around how could you not have medics also become equivalent training in our programs. It seemed like a no-brainer they would cross together. There are actually three complications. One is, once you get the college credit taken care of, we have to make sure that we are also institutionally accredited by very particular EMT paramedic accreditation organizations at the local level, which then lead to the licensure issue at the state level. So it really is a system of checks and balances around that quality that we're all going to be tackling at the same time, and we really are happy to participate in that. I think that one of the last things is we know that with scarce resources from our constituents, the last thing, and having been a community college graduate, the last thing that I enjoyed as a community college graduate was sitting through something I already knew. And when I taught computer science, I had a number of Navy folks who would come in, and I could turn the course over to them if I really needed to. And so for us, the general philosophy of it is we don't have enough money and resources to teach people something they already know. We need to save our resources to teach people who haven't learned that skill yet. So we're very much in favor. It is more complicated. We are still working very diligently around this. And with the decline in resources, we have to sit back and occasionally rethink how we approach this to continue our commitment. But our commitment is still there. So thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Joanne and Chris, thank you. I know this is very detailed. It's not an easy task, but I appreciate the work that's being done on it, because I think it's a critical component for our service members, our 40-40-20 goals in the state, on and on and on. And so I've never... Hopefully, I've never come across as going, what's the big deal? Got to be a piece of cake. Easy, easy stuff. I know it's not, but I applaud you for doing it. Now, one thing to the entire room, and I've had various conversations about this, is that once the program's put together and all the detailed work is done, and we kind of have a path to get a service member from here to certification or credit hours or whatever, please, 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 and this goes to the training issue. I really don't want to hear when a service member comes into a VSO or a community college or OUS that wasn't offered to me. That was never mentioned as a possibility. I want our VSOs trained. Our campus VSOs, if we have any left. but I'm sorry, that was low. $1 million short of perfection on that one. But, you know, I just want to make sure that everybody's on the same page, understands what is available to service members, and that it's being offered, and they're taken by the hand and walked through that. So,
anything else?
I'd just like to say thank you. Clackamas Community College continues to do an amazing job of working with veterans, making space for veterans on their campus. There's an event tomorrow at the campus that will be at 8:30 in the morning. trying to hire veterans. They've got a hiring event out there tomorrow. Just very dedicated. That's definitely coming from the top down.
Thank you.
That's passion in your heart for it, and I'm just appreciative that you're there and doing it, and we'll see you in the morning.
Thank you.
You know, and I'd also like to interject and say that we are very, very fortunate to have a committee like we have that are so dedicated to our veterans and to our soldiers. And that's to you, Representative Parrish, and to you, Representative Matthews, and to you, Representative Huffman, and Representative Boone, that isn't here, and of course, my co-chair, who has been just wonderful to work with. So the intent and the place in the heart that we have for our veterans shows in this committee, and I thank each and every one of you for that.
It's a good team. You know, we could just run the whole process.
We're taking over the House next.
So. That's right.
Yes, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for your testimony. Thanks for your efforts. Clackamas County, great job out there. Clackamas Community College.
Often.
Hiring heroes and also doing it out in, I think, Pendleton tomorrow as well, Blue Ridge. And I was very passionate as we made steps towards the EMT licensing issue. And at the time I had said, you know, there's a big push on behalf of the paramedics to say Oregon's the state that's leading by example by having a two-year degree in place. And I don't want to offend anybody when I said, you know, you're only a leader if there's people following you. They've been doing it 12 years and it hadn't taken bite with any other state. And when you said you don't have the resources to re-educate people on what they've already learned, my point of that is I appreciate that. I would also say those folks don't have the time to have to relearn it again either, when really what we need to do is get them in the workforce, get them contributing, and get them back into reintegration. So thanks for your efforts. Thanks for all your work. Mr. Mann, great job as always. And I know that we'll continue to work on this, and I understand how difficult it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have an update next on House Bill 3500 from the 211 session. We have General Caldwell was up and teed up and ready to go. Looks like he has some people with him that we left off the list. I'm sorry, General, you can't bring the Colonel. Step up here, Colonel.
I need him. Keep me straight.
And we know who you need. It's the lady here to keep you straight.
Yes, indeed. I need all the help I can get. I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Military Department. And also,
excuse me. Could you take that conversation outside, Major? Major?
Yeah.
Okay.
And also the
Thank you.
Interim head of the Office of Emergency Management. So it's a pleasure to be here today under House Bill 3500 that was passed by this body last year. We have a requirement to come in and discuss the challenges to reintegration, the barriers, cultural barriers that present problems, and for our soldiers to reintegrate, most of which you're going to hear from me today. You've heard bits and pieces of through your other testimony. So I think it's, and frankly, we didn't coordinate all this, so I think that's very good that when we can all kind of work in our independent silos, and then I hear the other testimony, and we're all singing off the same sheet of music, I guess the message is getting through. But so if it looks like we coordinated and we copied, we really didn't. So there's a list of topics we're going to discuss today. And here's, I think you can read as well as I can, but we have a highly motivated and disciplined and loyal and very proud force that as they serve and also after they discharge and become veterans in the community, which I think was demonstrated with previous testimony from ODVA about the quality of the individuals they have receiving the loans, which makes their loan profile look a lot better than perhaps other lenders. So I think that's one of the positive natures of the military service and military force. Most of the large majority of our service members do not experience major issues after they leave. When you look at the volume and the total numbers, and then you look at the ones that we have the difficulties with, it is a small percentage, but usually those are more pronounced issues too. So I think that also leads to more so than other maybe cultures you're going to see. When you do have a problem, it's a big problem. Many do have difficulty returning to civilian life, and that's why we have established our reintegration team. We saw this in 2004. We simply did not know what we did not know. we didn't even know who to get a hold of. In some cases, when we had a soldier who'd come back, we were getting pretty good. We were kind of getting overwhelmed initially with the requirement to push people out the door and get them into service, get them into federal service. All of a sudden, after this big push of getting people ready and making sure that they had all their paperwork done and all of the medical issues and family care issues and all of that, all of a sudden, the back doors, they're coming back home. And we weren't prepared, nor were we designed, outfitted, manned, or anything else to receive them. And we simply didn't know what to do about that. So we recognized it finally, almost kind of the two before between the eyes, with some real significant events that occurred with one of our units. And we said, we're going to establish this team. And we did it initially with state dollars only. We had no federal resources. Our governor and this legislature supported that. And again, I think it's became a model for other National Guard states. Our main objective is to connect soldiers and airmen with existing services and aid in the reintegration process. That's a big statement, but again, we didn't know what those services were that were available, and we needed to find out. We needed to get smart. We needed to get smart quick. And we've had, a wonderful response, not only from our communities at large, but also the service organizations and the Veterans Affairs, ODVA, and a whole host of folks that we didn't really know had a stake in this. Our first reintegration summit was about 6-7 years ago. We said, we've got all these folks that keep coming to us and telling us that they want to help. We really didn't have a mechanism to do that, so we said, let's have a summit and invite anybody and everybody and see who shows up. I think the first summit we had over 250 people show up. Many of them were individuals, and they had their own ideas on what they wanted to do, but we were able to kind of formulate that group, put them in different work groups so we could start coalescing this energy and all of this goodwill, and also finding out where these programs were or were not, because we just simply didn't know that. And I invite you to our next reintegration summit, which is going to be the 9th of February. Be down here at the Anderson Readiness Center at the end of State Street, State and Hawthorne. And we'd certainly like to see you come down if you've got a few minutes and you can kind of observe how this thing has developed over the years, because I think we've got a very, very good bunch of hardworking individuals that are out to try to solve problems, not create them. So that'll be coming up shortly. Mental health improvements. One of our big challenges in 2007 was we were tied with the great state of Minnesota as having the highest number of suicides of National Guard members in the United States. I can proudly report, knock on wood today, that we have not had a suicide in over 14 months in the state of Oregon for many of our members. So we're very, very pleased with that. We think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have put a lot of effort in the last 2 years, or since 2007, actually, to try to mitigate this problem. I don't think we fully understand it. None of us do. But what we have done is we have resiliency training going on. We've got Safe Talk family training. We have family life consultants that work for Michelle to my left, who runs our family program. And they're out in the communities now working with family members and other folks. We also have Partners in Care, Family Readiness Group, and Strong Bonds, which is a program that we work with the faith community to deal with throughout the state in every town or every location that we have a unit. Those efforts, I think, are starting to pay off, and we're also making sure that our leadership understands the importance that the Adjutant General has placed on this, which is one of his highest priorities, if not the highest priority. Just to give you an example, yesterday we had a soldier. It was yesterday. Had a soldier who attempted suicide. He was actually no longer in our organization, but we still had connections with him. He was trying to make an attempt at suicide, and it'll go to what we talked about earlier here. We ended up getting fairly good news coverage down in Roseburg, and there's a lot of people working with this individual now trying to, you know, get him taken care of, and he's in the Roseburg VA, which he has those rights to do that. He's no longer our member, but we still have people out working with him. The number one issue that he said, apparently, or his wife said to the news media, was he's got a four-month-old and a 2 to 3 year old, something like that. And she said his biggest issue was he was unemployed. He didn't have a job, and he couldn't provide for his family. So that's what was the driving force behind him deciding that they would be better off with his life insurance than they are with him. And I'm sure that's the issue. And I And so that goes back to what Co-Chair Witt and I have talked about on numerous occasions offline, is that if we want to solve a lot of these problems, I truly believe employment is the great solution, and we're continuing to work on that. Medical improvements, the great event occurred up with the 41st Brigade when they came back from Iraq. There was a lot of news media about it, about the fact that they were being rushed out of Fort Lewis without proper medical, without proper demobilization care. Senator Wyden got involved, Representative Schrader, Senator Merkley. There was a lot of high-level, four-star level from the Army. The Vice Chief of Staff actually flew out, dropped, cut all of his meetings, jumped on an airplane, flew to Fort Lewis to find out what's going on, which is when you get the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army showing up on your post to find out what's happening unannounced, basically, then you know that you've hit the cord. The problem that the Army had at that point, which we had suggested was an issue, is balancing that piece when a soldier comes home of getting them out of the process and getting them to their loved ones and making sure that they've been taken care of properly. The process was time-based at that point. You get X amount of days. Here's the laundry list of things you have to do, and you will get done by the end of those days, regardless of what may or may not be the case. And we've noticed this over the years that a lot of our soldiers would come back, have issues, get kicked off of active duty, and then it became a mammoth effort to get them back on federal active duty, get them back to get them treated, get them back to get them fixed, whatever the case may be. The Army changed their program after that incident. Now it is no longer time-based, it's issue-based. So you get done when you get done. But you have to do every one of the steps, and they have to be completely completed, and you have to be satisfied. The Army's got to be satisfied, we have to be satisfied, and the soldier has to be satisfied that, yes, they've accomplished those issues, and yes, they've been taken care of. So the time-based is gone, which is a very, very good movement by the Army, and they're doing this throughout all their demob sites now, and I think we've seen just a huge improvement with the last unit we just brought home, the 3rd of the 116th Eastern Oregon Organization, and it was issue-based, not time-based. So we're pleased about that, and we think that's a big, big step forward to try to mitigate these issues and not have them linger for months and years after the fact. As I indicated, employment is the number one issue in my mind. I think that respect to both the military culture and the civilian culture, I truly believe that there's a bias toward military service members by public employers. I think it's less so in the private side, but it is there as well. It's hard to define, it's hard to prove, but anecdotally, when we have soldiers come in and they say, well, yeah, we've changed the law, we get these things, but it's just pro forma. I mean, we didn't have a shot the minute we walked in, and we knew it, and we hear that all too often. On the civilian side, we also notice that on the civilian side, as far as employment goes, that a lot of employers are nervous about another deployment. So they're reluctant to maybe move somebody up to the top of the list, even though they really like that individual. They say the interview went great, everything was going fine, I thought I was going to get the job, and then they said, are you still in the Guard? And I said, yes, and they said, are you going to deploy again? I don't know, probably. And then thank you, pleasant interview, and they never hear another word. So I think there's truly a bias when it comes to employment toward soldiers and their reemployment, not necessarily reemployment. I think we've done a good job of educating our employers throughout, particularly the private industry, less so in the governmental employees. I think we still deal with a lot of those, explaining the law, reintegrating them into what their responsibilities are for reemployment. Less so on the civilian side. I think the average private employer in this state does a very good job of that. But I think initial employment is still an issue, and I think it will be. And I'm not sure how we're going to address that. We're going to keep educating folks, as Major Leibel indicated earlier, and I think that's probably the key to trying to succeed in that area. You just got done with a couple panels on converting the military training certificates to licenses, and I applaud you for what this legislature's done. I think that's going to weigh heavily on our soldiers and all soldiers and veterans coming home and help them get reemployed as quickly as they can. And I think that's exciting to see see the direction the state of Oregon's going in that regard. We all know deployments disrupt the service member, their employer, their spouse, their families. We've been able to put together, I think, a good our family program is probably one of the best in the country of trying to educate family members of what to expect, not only pre-deployment, during deployment, and post-deployment. Still a challenge, but again, we are better situated now thanks to the resources that DOD has put into our state to be able to do that, which was timely because of the lack of state monies. We pulled pretty much all of the state monies out of the reintegration program. There's very little left in that program right now. Other issue that we see is soldiers come back, they can get minimum wage jobs, it's hard to get the family wage job. And again, I think that's a product of our time more so than probably anybody, anybody excluding our service members. And it was always a challenge to balance your civilian and military career. Financial issues, as we know, that, and you've heard in many, many forums, veterans struggle adjusting from the deployment income to the post-deployment. Major Leibel talked about that in his session. It works both ways. In some situations, we have soldiers that are actually making more money because they were unemployed when they went into the deployment. Then they come back and they have zero or very little, and they're ending up on, $200 a week for unemployment insurance. And that's challenging for them because they have 18 months or so of one form of income, and all of a sudden it's cut off. We work extremely hard to try to educate the families to understand that phenomenon, understand what's going to happen. You're going to see, in some cases, more money than you've seen in a long time. You have to be wise on how you do that because it's going to end. Mm-hmm. And nevertheless, we still have many problems financially with folks. We have one financial planner in the state that's provided, is paid for by the Department of Defense. Again, works for Michelle, and he does the best job he can to try to deal with the onesie-twosies, the real problems. We're trying to expand that to get more pro bono work, more like the Bar Association has done with CPAs, et cetera, just to take a page out of their book, and we're going to be working on that. Again, they have trouble controlling their spending. Biggest problem is our emergency relief fund due to the economy. We have two of them, actually. We had one that legislature provided for us. It's almost depleted. I think there's just a few thousand dollars left in it. And then we have a second one, which is a 501c3 that is operated by a separate board, but that's one we use and we get donations to it. Those donations have been waning over the difficult economy. This time of year, we seem to get a few more in, but it's still a challenge. And we're very disciplined in how we put that money out. Real desperate situations, we do to have that emergency relief. The Army also has an emergency relief fund, which is fairly efficient considering the size of the group that they deal with nationwide. But ours is a lot quicker. We can usually take a problem, address it the same day, and have a check either that day or the next day out to the individual. So very rare that we'll ever go past 4 days from the time we understand the request and validate the request and also get the check out. If it's over that, it's very rare. There's a problem somewhere. Education issues. We've found that many of our returning veterans are attending school, and we think that's largely due to the economy. They can't find a job. The new GI Bill offers a lot of good benefits toward them, and we've encouraged them to do that. So we've seen that number rise predominantly in the community college area. That seems to be the place of choice for certification and or for an associate's degree. Of course, our deployment cycles don't coincide with schools. Legislature did make some changes probably 5-6 years ago now, maybe 7, to allow soldiers who have to deploy in midterm to conserve their credit and not be punished and also be able to return back and take advantage of what they couldn't do. So that was a good change that the Oregon legislature made, and I think that's helped us. Tuition's gone up, of course, and the other issue that a lot of people don't understand, particularly with the Guardsmen or Reservists, is that in order to get the full GI Bill, you have to do 3 years active duty. Most of our folks do 12 to 18 months on their initial deployment. Many of our folks have qualified for the full deal because they've deployed 3-4 times, but a lot of them haven't, and so they get a third of that. So it's not as robust as maybe the advertisement says, but yet it's still very, very helpful because it has a stipend with it, as well as just not only pay for books and education, but it also has a stipend. Back to the education issues, as you can see, the 41st Brigade, when it returned, 51% reported they would be unemployed when they were in Iraq. 1 year later, 13% reported they're still employed or still unemployed, which coincides with the 12.7% you heard just a minute ago from Mark from DOD. 22% reported that they went to school, post-secondary education. Again, that means our message is getting out. Here's the opportunities. You need to look at these because you've got some advantages here and take care of them. And we're pleased with that number. About 70% of that group reported they were going to community colleges. So again, I think the community college network has been wonderful to work with, and we've had great response, and our soldiers like it. And it's local. It's close to home. 3116, who just returned, like I said, 31% reported they were unemployed upon their demobilization. 7% indicated they'd be attending school. Since they just got back, we're at about 90 days out from their return, right, coming up on 90 days. We don't have all the numbers yet. We'll be getting those in as they start returning to their regular drills and doing the and taking care of the outreach. This is one of my favorite pictures that came out about 3 weeks after the war, the ground war began in Iraq. And if you can't read that, it says the sign says 1 weekend a month my ass. So that's.
I thought that's what it said.
That's what it said. Sure.
Thank you for stating that for the record.
Yeah. I want to make sure everybody got the essence of that. So I think what that sign tells you is that, our organization has changed over the last 8 years. We are no longer the strategic reserve that, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer, best part-time job in America. It still is the best part-time job in America, but you're probably going to go to some foreign land and you're going to get to meet people that you've never met before and see cultures you've never seen. So that's almost a guarantee. That's what we tell our soldiers when they enlist. There is no will I deploy, it's a question of when you will deploy. Geographical disbursement's always been a challenge for our organization. That's why we term ourselves Fort Oregon, because we go border to border, north, south, east, west. It's difficult when we only see our people when they return 1 weekend a month. We're looking at strategies as how we're going to do that with the technology. As you know, we had some federal funding, and we created Fort Oregon, which was a website for people to come in, and basically one-stop shop was our intention. That funding has depleted on the federal side. We no longer have that. We've got other workarounds we're looking at, and we're looking at other strategies to try to fill that gap, but we simply didn't have the money to continue it, no state money, and the federal money was cut short as well. We know that it's more difficult to deal with our rural soldiers than it is our more metro soldiers because of just where the resources are. The federal VA has done a great job, I think, of establishing clinics that were previously not available to soldiers, like in La Grande and Bend. Those are new. We've got one in Astoria, and there's numerous other ones around the state that didn't used to be there. It was basically Roseburg, White City, Portland. So we've gotten a good reach, I think a much better reach from the federal VA, which is helping us a lot. We still have our armories, and we still encourage all of our people to stay in contact with our armories. Again, we're looking at strategies that not only allow the soldiers, because they're as you talk to these 20-some-year-old kids and you say, okay, what do you guys use and what do you want to do? And what do they tell us? They say, well, I've got to have my iPhone, got to have the app, got to, we're not there. We're going to go there. And we're looking at, we pulled these folks together and say, how do we get you that information? So we're strategizing on how to do that, create our own Fort Oregon app, if you will, and you can jump in on that, and any kid can sit in the movie theater or wherever he's at and get on his iPhone and do his thing, or his iPad, or his iTouch, or his I, whatever, or the Zinc, some of the other ones, Droid, that's it, yeah, Droid. So we're trying to get connected with these kids in the manner of which they communicate, because standing in front of a formation preaching it, yeah, we do that, and we'll continue to do that, but that isn't how they operate. Nobody talks to one another anymore. They never get on the phone and say, hey, how are you? They text, they go to that. So we're trying to learn from that, have them teach us how can we best deliver this information. As indicated in previous testimony, educating these folks is the number one thing. If we can find that repository where they can get in and they can get their info, that's what they want to do. They don't want me to stand up and preach to them. They want to be able to find it on their own. So we're trying to figure out that mechanism to make it work a lot better than it has in the past. Unfortunately, a lot of times we learn of problems through the law enforcement community, and we've known that for a number of years, or we learn it through the media. And so those are the things that that we know that are impacting, these young soldiers don't have those battle buddies, don't have that structure that they had when they were in Iraq. And they, without that structure, without that communication, they sometimes don't do so well. We find out about it. We send our reintegration team, our unit members, to deal with these folks as quick as we can. Family relationship issues is always a challenge. We know that. Our divorce rates and alcohol abuse and depression are higher than the average society. We know that. You saw one of the mentioned strong bonds. That's one of our programs, as I said, through the faith community to try to address that. We have also, the marriage counseling.
It's with Strong Bonds.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Part of the Strong Bonds program where we actually, DOD pays for families to come on a weekend. We have a whole array of counselors that are available, chaplains, et cetera, and go through a course to help them understand their relationship better and try to mitigate maybe some of the issues that have created post-deployment. We run that course about...
Once a month.
Once a month. Mm-hmm. And we ask people to sign up. That it doesn't cost them anything. We pay for their hotel, where I think the last one was up at Welch's, wasn't it? Up at Welch's, so we try to find a venue that's pleasant and refreshing, bring them in, put them there, and say, you're going to learn something this weekend, and maybe this will help you in your marriage. It's been successful. We get good reports back. Problem is, we can't get everybody to it. They don't want to, they've made decisions. There's been a lot of water under the bridge, and probably the ones that need it the most don't show up. But we know that it's helping those that will show. And we've seen good results from that and good feedbacks. So this is kind of a laundry list of what we're doing. Of course, have pre-deployment. We have during the deployment exercises, family programs, meetings, groups, all kinds of education. We work closely with the families in our communities just before they come home. And then we have the 30, 60, 90-day post-deployment training and 90-day post-deployment health assessment. We've learned over the time that initially, again, they want to get home, they may hide something at Fort Lewis or wherever their demob station is. At 30 days and 60 days, they're really barely interested in listening to anything. At 90 days, those problems have really reached a problem point, and now they're willing to talk. So that's when we do the health assessment. Every soldier has to do that. We have the Transition Assistance Program, which is basically jobs, thanks to the Oregon Employment Division, our department. They've been our partner, as has been ODVA and other, been excellent partners in trying to find work, trying to find jobs. And again, I want to take my hat off to many of the people in our private industry, because they have really leaned forward. And I'll call attention of Platt Electric, Harvey Platt. He's hired I don't know how many hundreds of, and he's got a big organization statewide, northwest-wide, and he prefers to hire veterans, and he does it very, very well. Family life consultants, family assistance specialists, family readiness group, all of these things we have in play right now. And we use them in a coordinated method, depending on what the soldier may need and who we can apply to it. We have youth programs, of course, that we do, that falls again under Michelle to my left, deals with not only, particularly when the children are gone. Well, we just finished a major military child education coalition where Representative Parrish was a co-chair with former Senator, State Senator Martha Schrader. It was a very successful meeting here in Salem, a three-day period. We're establishing how can we reach out and educate educators here in this state so they can understand what that child is maybe going through because their parents are deployed. I mean, that's it. That's the essence of it. But more importantly, let's not only figure out who this community is, but educate them on what they can do to help this child. We think this is a rather new a new initiative on our part, started last spring, I guess it was, Representative, and I think we're moving
through the first step. We've broken through the first step, and now the hard work starts. And I think we had a wonderful group of community members from all over the state of Oregon arrive here in Salem, spend the 3 days with us, and I think they left extremely charged up and ready to go to work. And so we're looking forward to seeing the results of that. I mentioned the summits. Operation Silver Wing is basically a partnership that we created with Software Association of Oregon. They came to us and said we would like to help and how to get people employed. We pulled together three different events so far where we bring in employers, and these are the big guys, these are the corporate heads, and we get the CEOs. We don't get the public affairs rep. We get the CEOs at these things. They know how to do this. They're good at it. They get high visibility, and I think it's paying great dividends right now because it's helping educate them on what is a veteran and what do these folks need. So that's been very positive as well. I mentioned the job fairs as of again tomorrow, and one in Clackamas, one in Pendleton, and of course resume help, practice interviews, again working with our partner in the employment division, and that's been very, very helpful. And anytime we put together one of our groups, they have somebody there to help us with that, learn how to get on WorkSource Oregon, learn how to apply for work, learn how to do these things. So recommendations. Our recommendations, again, are going to follow pretty much what you already have on your plate and are moving forward with. State certifications and licensing and credit, we've discussed that. We think there needs to be more, at least as much emphasis on the pre-deployed people getting employment as well as the post-deployed as well. And we think we can do better in that regard, and I think the state can do a lot better if we choose to do that. We're looking for support for our relief fund, as I mentioned. A big piece, we believe, if there was one of the high priorities, is reestablish the campus veteran service officers. We know that that helped a lot. We know that it's made a difference. We'd like to see that one reestablished somehow. And one of the ways that we might look at, because the lottery was mentioned earlier again with, I think, Mr. Mann, and again, we didn't talk before this meeting, but which I was glad to hear him say that. The lottery is restricted to economic development and education. So campus veterans service officer may be perfect for one of the raffles or special raffles like they do for St. Patty's Day and Thanksgiving and those, the one-time deals. We've had discussions with the lottery, and they're certainly willing to work with us on that. They recognize that. I think a good push from this body would be even better. And then continue to strengthen all those partnerships that I mentioned before and through our summits. We're going to continue our resiliency programs. We know that that's paying dividends to us at this point. And make sure our leaders and our folks understand the importance of this and how valuable it can be. If I had an ask, I would say that we have depleted our reintegration program with state dollars, and that's we're living off the federal dime. We know that more than likely that given what's going on in Congress, that's going to change. It's going to change for the worse, and we're not going to have those dollars. And so I would hate to see our reintegration efforts constricted, but if they do, then I think we need to be looking at how do we fund them from the state level to keep them up and operational. Again, I talked about the Fort Oregon, the military assistance line. We have a contract right now with Cascade Centers, which also does the employee assistance program for the state of Oregon. We talked about that at the last hearing you had. That contract will end in a year. That was special money that came out basically through the feds. When it's gone in a year, we don't know that it'll be back. So we're maybe back asking for help on that. And then again, the last thing is our Fort Oregon website that we have not funded. It's no longer, it's actually still up. I don't know if they just forgot to turn it off, and it still works, but we haven't been paying them. So we're kind of living off their good graces right now at this point, and we'll continue to do that. But at some point, I know it's going to get the switch is going to get pulled. So with that, again, I think our most important thing is not only educating our own members, but educating the public in general. And with me today, and I apologize for not formally announcing Michelle Kachowski, who runs our family program, and Colonel Dave Ferre, who's the new head of what we call our J-9 operation or reintegration programs. Colonel Ferre is the new boss, been there, 60 days now? It just seems like 5 years? Yeah. He said it seems like 5 years, but I think it's 60 days. So. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? For Florida Parish.
Mike, we talked a little bit about the suicide line, and I'm kind of looking at an email I have in my inbox that there's a rumor, and I don't like to deal in rumor, but there's a, you know, the thought that Cascade is, that it may or may not have enough funds to do this, or they're realizing it might take more than that they first, you know, bid. Is there any truth to that, or is there any concern that, you know, they're not going to be able to perform that function, or with the budget that they bid on?
Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and Representative Parrish, I've not had any requests from them one way or the other with respect to that. Have you? I will tell you that they have met or exceeded every one of the contract requirements at this point. We certainly have no issues with the performance at this stage of the game. We're relatively new into the game, 60 days now, pushing on 90. So if that is the case, then I would expect they would come to us and make that request. But I have not, okay. I have not gotten that.
Representative Parrish, I'm going to meet with Senator Boquist because it's my understanding they have approached him.
Okay. Well, we'll go back, have a representative, and we'll go back and we'll talk to him, and we'll find out if that's the case.
Co-chair. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to recognize that there was a lot of thought and preparation that went into this. I find it very informative, and I just wanted to let General Caldwell know that all the time and effort that was put into this preparation is appreciated.
Thank these two people on my left and my
thank
right.
Thank you both very much.
I'm the editor.
They're the creators.
Any other comments or questions from the panel?
Thank you, General.
Again, we appreciate
always a pleasure.
The opportunity. Always appreciate
it. I believe there's somebody in the audience that, do you have business with the committee?
Chairman Bell and board, I'm
Let's just wait a second until we can get you to a
I'll
microphone.
I'll get you down to the mic. Thank you.
Chairman Escavel and board. My name is Doug Kuhl. I'm from Cascade EAP, retired colonel in the Oregon Army National Guard. Sir, we did meet with Representative Boquist yesterday. We didn't ask him for additional money. We just wanted to explain to him what our program was about, and we're going to have no problem.
I believe he's a senator.
I'm sorry, senator. Sir. Did I say representative?
Although Brian doesn't care one way or the other.
So we just met with him as an information brief, 15 minutes, explaining to him what Cascade EAP is able to do. And we're going to have no problem meeting this contract with the Oregon National Guard and all veterans in Oregon. So.
That clears that up.
Excellent.
But I'm still meeting with Senator Boquist.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, sir. Anything else for the good of the order? Representative Parrish.
Well, I did want to talk about the MSET conference a little bit because we did have about 130 people from across the state, huge showing from Ontario. Oregon showed up, a contingent from there. Certainly that's one of the PCS locations where soldiers rotate through. And, you know, what came out of that? And essentially the process was is we met, so the Military Child Education Coalition came out, they facilitated for us. We brought in leaders from the business community, policymakers, educators, healthcare. So just this very wide spectrum. And they worked in groups in their sectors, and they came up with what their sector could do right now to help a military child, what we would need to do potentially from a policy perspective, and how we engage the rest of the state. And so that steering committee who's organized this is going to meet again probably in January, and we're going to look at how we roll out smaller engagements like that across the state so that people know what those resources are. I had a police chief or sergeant from my district who attended, immediately took his materials, handed them off to the school police officer who goes around and patrols school campuses and works in the high school and is already kind of rolling that out. So we're already hearing some really good feedback from the event. And like I said, we'll be working on an engagement and potentially Clackamas and Ontario as the first two rollouts of how those resources are. And then hoping that this committee and on the Senate side would be, you know, as policy things come up that we would need to address, that we'd be open to what those look like. There's about 11,000 kids in Oregon who are somehow tied to a service professional. So it was a great event, a two-day event, not 3 days, but it was good. And MSEC was wonderful. They came in, they paid for the whole thing, they hosted the whole thing, did not cost the state of Oregon a dime to get it done other than people's time. And they are going to continue to be there as a resource for us. So very productive and truly, you know, bipartisan effort to look at these kids and go, how do we help solve these things? I also met with the folks in between breaks from the DMV, and we all get a lot of license plate bill issue or questions and concerns with veterans plate. They are actually told me that they're going to work on taking steps to resolve some of the issues that we kind of get repeatedly around veterans plates, and they're going to try and tackle that through the rule process and solve it. So how do you have a spouse who the car is registered in their name, but, you know, for credit purposes, sometimes soldiers screw up their credit early on and can't get a car, but it's the soldier's car for all intents and purposes, and how do we, you know, all those kind of things that constituents are talking to us about these veterans plates. DMV came in as a very proactive and wanted to give them kind of a shout out that they're working on solving that without us having to do anything legislatively to solve it.
I imagine Representative Beyer will just smile over that one.
He loves
those license plates.
That's right.
Co-Chair Witt. Mr. Co-Chairman, with the deadline coming up for committee bills, it would be helpful, I think, if any of the committee members let us know any intentions that they would have for committee bills. We have one that's out so far, urging chiropractic care for all vets. I would very much like for our committee to move on the direct licensure of veterans. That would be two out of our five, if it's agreeable to all the committee members. And I'm wondering if there are any others that you and I ought to know about at this point.
Do you have anything?
Yeah, and I will either drop it as my priority bill, or it could be the committee bill. And it's one that we had discussed, and we actually had a little anxiety over, so we opted to back off of that. Now we have what's been interesting is, and it was 3668 was the original bill, and you might recall that was one with if a veteran were to have an issue through BOLI, they would notify the Department of Veterans Affairs, and what it does is gives access notification to the DVA so that they can get involved in this veteran and find out if they're getting access to all their benefits and to help them through this process. What's been interesting is, you know, we had a little anxiety, a little struggle, but the power struggle has gone away. All agencies seem to be very comfortable with this, Attorney General's office as well as BOLI. And so BOLI's actually been implementing this, and I understand we've had good success at this point. So the question is, well, why do you have a bill? The reason that I would suggest we still do the bill, and I think it's important, is that I think now is the time. And we're not always going to have this dynamic of the commissioner supportive and DVA accepting and AG affirming. So I think what we need to do is kind of codify it so that we say this is what we're going to do. So when veterans have an issue and they notify somebody, those folks notify the DVA and Department of Veterans Affairs, make sure that those are veterans that are getting access. So that was, again, 3668. It's being redrafted.
So you're basically doing a notification process in the bill.
It's really simple. It's a very simple, straightforward bill. I don't think there'll be any anxiety. If you would like to have it for a committee bill, that's fine. I feel strongly that it needs to be done enough to where that will be my priority bill. But again, if the committee is looking for bills, I think that's a great idea. The other thing that that I'm just curious, and again, as a concept, and I think the good co-chair Witt and I have discussed it the other day, and that is whether or not we have I'll bet we have something in place, and maybe Mr. Mann can tell us, but I'd like to find a way to recognize those folks that are doing exceptional things for the veterans in public and private sector. I think we have several of them, but in case I'm looking at the City of Gresham, where as an entity, the City of Gresham has made a commitment to veterans that they will make up differential pay for city employees that get deployed. That's a huge thing for our families. When you look at some of the salaries that some of these folks, we have a top step sergeant in the police Police Department has been deployed 3 times. This is a big deal for those families. That's a big commitment. And the kind of thing I love, we're leading by example. And I don't know if there's anything in place now that we recognize or that we direct to recognize. There's got to be something out there, and maybe I can take that on the side with Tom and Jim and the others and General Caldwell. But I just would like to say, I know there's more stories out there. Gresham's not the only people doing exceptional work. I know there's a bunch of private sector businesses that do incredible things for veterans and their families. I'd like to find a way to bring recognition to that so it might inspire others to do the same.
You mean kind of a recognition award for a private and a public sector?
If needed, Mr. Chair, I don't know if that goes in resolution format or how you do that. It may already exist. I've just started. We're probably into, eighth year of doing this, seventh year of doing this with the city. Every year they renew it. It's a commitment from Mayor Shane Bemis and the council. I think it's worthy of the recognition, but I think there's more than just them doing it. So I'm trying to explore that. Again, it may not be a committee bill, but something certainly that I'd like to get out in the forefront from this body to say, here's who's doing outstanding work, and it might bring more out to us too, because there's a lot of good stories out there, and I think a lot of folks are doing right, and a lot of other folks might be inspired by the need and actually follow.
Coach Irwin?
We've also heard a lot today about various needs, and we've heard needs for additional capital to loan out for the mortgage program. General Caldwell and his staff have made a number of recommendations. I for one would like to see the campus VSOs restored. There are a number of things here that we don't have the money for necessarily. Representative Parrish and I were passing notes back and forth here, and she suggested a Veterans Day lottery where we purchase the special tickets, a special lottery on that one day. The lottery already does it. They do it, three, four times a year. Maybe we have one that's dedicated for veterans-related issues, and the department can figure out how much they need to restore VSOs, how much they need for mortgages, and the laundry list of other things that we need.
Can we bring General Caldwell up?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have had this conversation with the lottery department. And again, the Constitution restricts it to economic development and education. So with those two restrictions, they indicated, Larry Nieswender, their director, indicated, he said, yes, it could be done, and I think their commission would be very interested in doing that. I don't know that it takes a law, maybe just the continued conversation. If it was dedicated to education, then I would think that campus VSOs would fit that bill. And I would think that might be okay to do with that specific goal in mind. But I know Cameron has had some discussions as well, so maybe...
For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, policy advisor with the Governor's Office in Military Veterans and Emergency Management. And we've kicked this idea around a lot. There's a lot that we hear across education, healthcare, employment, in terms of coordination and being more efficient and more effective with the resources that we do have. But at the end of the day, to do good work on so many different levels here, it takes budget and staffing to be able to do that. The Campus Veteran Service Officers is a great example. Work on our women's veterans issues. There's just a host of issues that we could go towards. In our sense, there's always competition for general fund. There's always competition for lottery dollars. I think our sense is that there would be a growing of the pie if you had a scratch it ticket that was dedicated for veterans issues. It does have to pass that constitutional sniff test in terms of economic development and education. But there's a vast amount of need in that area that we hear every day from veterans in the military. So I don't see any, I think we could raise $2 to $5 million off of a scratch it ticket, knowing that I don't play the lottery because I'm not in it for the investment sake, and know that 97 cents of every dollar goes to the state. But I would buy it if I knew that was going to veterans' issues.
It'd be required if you did that.
I'll be buying them.
It's for entertainment purposes.
That's right.
So, the raffle that they do, beyond just like having that scratch-it available the month of November or whatever, you know, the raffle on, you know, drawing on a Veterans Day,
yeah.
They sell 250 tickets. They're $10 each. The payout's $1 million to the winner. That's a $1.5 million left. I'm sure the Lottery Commission has some administrative costs with, you know, doing that and then whatever the commission they pay to the whoever sold the winning ticket, et cetera, but I have to assume that leaves a pretty significant chunk of money. And even if that's $1 million left over, you're talking 8 to 10 VSOs across the state.
And the lottery is incredibly efficient in terms. You know, we have probably 152 veterans organizations out there raising money that each of them have overhead. This is a way that it gets it out there to the broader community. Taps into. I mean, it's a war bond mentality.
That's right.
You're not doing it. I'm not buying that ticket
to win.
If I win, great. But knowing that that's going to campus, I mean, there's a need that the community wants to support, and we need to be able to give them that, I think.
Now, can we put this on the record that if you do win, you will turn that money back over?
I
just want to be clear on this.
To the Oregon Guard's emergency relief.
He's on the record.
You didn't say all money.
And Washington has, they do this in the state of Washington. I'm not sure. Obviously, their laws are different with their lottery funds, but I know they do that, and I think it's either one or two times a year that they have special things for veterans to do that so they can fund some of these issues.
I'll share as well. Since we've closed the program, I've had four universities and two community colleges contact us saying, could you please send us somebody on a regular basis? And I've had to say, no, we cannot do that.
You know, the challenge with there's dollars out there. You know, the community colleges came to my office the other day. We had talked about community colleges and how do we pick up the tuition. And then it came back and said, did you know that there's actually a program that, you know, $953 a month and some education. And problem is we don't have enough people to communicate the benefits, and it's an entitlement program. So they would get those dollars on top of Pell Grant. We don't have enough people out there to communicate to the 300-some thousand veterans all of the different types of things they're eligible for. And as a state, we leave a lot of money on the table. Federal dollars that Oregon right now is a donor state, right? We, for every dollar we send to Uncle Sam, we're not getting the dollar back. So if we have people who are actually, if we have a way to fund, dedicated fund for people like a VSO who can pull those education dollars from that are federal entitlement dollars back to Oregon, that is enriching the wealth of this state. And I think it's worth having a conversation about how we actually do that to leverage those dollars.
We asked the governor's office and the military department to work in conjunction with the lottery department and come back with a suggestion.
I think that's good, and maybe we
you guys think of that?
Maybe we just have a memorial or something, too, to that effect.
What's that?
Maybe we just have a memorial to that effect, too.
Maybe we define that somewhere in statute that a VSO is an educational, I mean, so that it meets the criteria.
I mean, it is an educational piece because it's educating the veterans on what they have available to them. And what they can and cannot do, and I think that's pretty. I think that's very important.
Well, we probably all agree with that in this group. But I would imagine if there's some, we butt up against an obstacle. I'd like us to be thinking about that, what that obstacle could be, and how we clear the fence so that.
That's why I said let's let them come back with a package.
You also have all the community colleges and the university system. They do what they call the last dollar as well. I think you're familiar with that. You've had testimony before about that. I don't know if there'd be any residual after we do the county or the campus veteran service officers, but if there was, these folks are already picking up the tab for when soldiers or veterans don't have that much. And that's 100% education. You can't argue that piece. So I think if there was residuals left over, that's where I would plug it in.
That's right.
Because they're already putting it in.
With Christmas coming up, they've got an opportunity to develop a wish list that falls within the purview of the lottery and let us know what that is so that we could, if there needs to be legislation, we could get it in before the deadline.
Mm-hmm. We'll get with Larry in the next few days.
And committee bills are December 5th deadline, too, so we
I think it is December 5th.
Yeah. But that's coming up here pretty soon.
His legislative staff's probably watching it and already has him on the tube.
Really fast.
Recapping where we're at this point in terms of potential committee bills, we've got the chiropractor one that's already drafted.
Right.
We've got the potential for the direct licensure. Representative Matthews, what was the number of your former bill?
It was 3668. And Derek Bradley in my office has done an outstanding job keeping up on this issue and following along with meetings and whatnot. I really do think the anxiety is going to be removed. It'll be a very simple bill.
We've got the potential for the recognition that you talked about. And then should we need something statutorily to provide for the lottery, that would be our fifth one. So we may have our quota here.
Now, if I remember correct, on the bill that you were you're proposing, the only anxiety was that we were empowering the Department of Justice with some empowerment, that there was some block of that.
This just simply is a notification bill at this point. And like I said, it's already being done. It's tried and true, and I don't know if you need
it.
But this puts it in statute, and it kind of makes it, this is what we're going to do, despite having people that are all on board now. That may not be the case 5 and 10 years from now. So
it's been changing of the guard.
Even 5 months.
Co-chairs, I can tell you that the Boley relationship is fantastic. Every time they get a veteran in the door, I'm their contact. They contact me directly. I have given 4 presentations to Boley in various divisions about what we're doing. I'm speaking at their annual conference on December 2nd again, which will be my fifth presentation in front of Boley. It's fantastic. And now is the time to strike because everyone gets along.
Mom, can I have the keys of the car?
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order?
I like this.
Okay, we have 5 potential bills.
Yeah.
So we'll proceed on and direct our staff to do so. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I appreciate very much your being here, and I appreciate you as a committee. I really do.
Great work, Mr. Chair.
Good work. Without further ado, if we have nothing for the betterment of the order, we'll go ahead and we'll close the public hearing on the informational hearing, and then we'll adjourn the committee.
Cool.